Yeah, Anthony, John, I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Banter, a BMX podcast.
You're listening to Banter, a BMX podcast with John Doker and Anthony Berardi. Our next guest hails from Indianapolis, Indiana. He grew up riding with BMX legends Perry Merver, Steve Mulder, and Danny Ming. Inventor of the Whopper, aka Hop Whip, as well as a bunch of other tricks, rode for DK, TNT, Haro, Homeless Bikes, S&M, GT Bikes, Schwinn, and Master Blaster Planet, currently riding for Flatland Assassins, was the creator of Pulse Products in 89 to 92, Standard in 92, Indie Industries in 93. Pulse Products is the company that designed Pulse Pegs, the first mass-produced real bolt-on axle pegs, also bringing a better and stronger unbrake to the masses to make a coaster brake turn into a free coaster. He was one of the original three founders of Standard Bikes. He's been performing shows for 40 years now and is the owner of Wonder Wheels BMX Stunt Team. He is in the 500,000-plus mile club on his GMC Denali, the owner of two brand-new titanium hips. Welcome to the show, Mr. Bill Nischke.
Great to have you on.
I was just thinking to myself, Bill, that you're literally two hip.
Yeah. Two new ones. I'm stoked.
How's that going? You recovering?
Yeah, doing pretty good. I mean, I haven't missed a show yet, even with the hip surgeries.
Wow.
You're riding now.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long's it been? How long's it been?
What's that?
How long's it been since you had the surgeries?
Let's see here. About 4.5 months now since the first surgery, and 5 weeks less than that. So 3 and a quarter months. Something like that. Yeah.
Wow. What would you say percentage wise? Are you at 50% or better than that?
Maybe it's more the strength right now than anything, you know, and that's been the hardest part, is just rebuilding the strength, you know, when you don't have it and you're like, oh man, any day now. So I'm at that point now where I'm noticing things leaps and bounds every day. I'm noticing something a little bit different, you know, and how I walk, the strength that I have, and, you know, walking again, turning, pivoting. I haven't done a decade yet. I know that. So I'm not ready to jump like that, but, I'm ready to run, you know, as soon as I can. I mean, it's Jason Voorhees could catch me pretty quick right now if he chased me down.
They got you doing squats and stuff, or you just ride?
I'm just trying to take it easy. There's so many muscles in your, like in the side of your hips there that have to reattach and regrow. And not only that, but like all the muscles that were attached to the bone that they cut off at the top of your femur, all that's got to reattach. And it's like, I don't know if you've ever seen a diagram of the leg muscles or anything like that, but my gosh, there's a lot in there, man. And it's going to take a while, you know, just for all that. So I can bend down, squat, things like that. But to jump right back up real quick, I'm not that fast with that yet. I don't have that kind of strength back in my legs.
I feel like I saw a picture of the bone that was just on a table. It looked like something you could throw to your dog. Was that your hip?
Yeah, that was the top of the femur. So I asked my surgeon when he came in, you know, he kind of checks everything out and he's like, all right, you ready to go? Yeah, mark that leg. All right, this is the one. And I was like, hey, by the way, I go, when you cut the top of my femur off, I said, can you bring that to me? And he's like, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And he's like, but I'll take some pictures for you. So those are actually the pictures that the surgeon took in the OR, like when he cut them off.
You don't get to keep your hip?
No, it's kind of like they don't let you keep your teeth either. Like if you get your teeth yanked, you know, you could, like, if somebody died or something like that, you could throw your teeth in there, you know, and falsify some, like, you know, crazy stuff. That's probably why. But I don't know why they wouldn't let you keep a bone. It's not like you're doing anything to
It's your bone. I mean,
I know.
Not anymore.
It's somebody's idea of, like, you can't have your stuff anymore. I don't.
Yeah.
That's one person. Doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem right.
What I said, but I was like, take some photos.
All right, Bill, we got some questions, and then the reader mail is ridiculous. There's so many people chimed in here, so let's get to some questions. We're not here, you know, until tomorrow. I guess you're a popular guy, Bill. So what can you do?
Yeah, hey, man, I just live my life every day to the fullest.
How do we spell your name?
BN. That's the short version.
Right, right. It's NITSCHAE, right?
NITSCHKE.
Man, I've gone to Facebook so many times to make sure that I spelt it right.
You ought to hear how many people, like how many friends of mine try to pronounce that in several different ways. It's hilarious. I still think Matt Hoffman says it the funniest. Him and Brian Strebe. Niski.
How do they say it?
Kind of like Niski. Yeah. Like you would spell it N-I-S-K-I or something.
Like it's silent T.
Polish. It's German.
It's German.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's start off with an easy question. How did it all begin, Bill?
Back in 1976, my parents got me a bike. I went out and rode around for about 3 minutes, fell off, scabbed my knee, put a Band-Aid on it, and got back on the bike and kept going and never looked back. And then I popped wheelies after I saw Evel Knievel doing wheelies, standing on the seat. And that's why I kind of do that in the show. Like a Blither wheelie, that's what I'm talking about. I do that forward and backwards. That's Blither, you know, does it obviously, but like that was what got me attracted to just popping wheelies. And after that, it was just the freedom that you had to ride a bike anywhere, you know, was you could get places quicker. It was more fun. So that was pretty much the attraction, was just the freedom that I had on it.
Evel Knievel. So yeah, I guess we should ask how old are you, Bill?
53 now.
You're 53. Okay.
Yeah. I'll be 54 in September.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Still a young man. Still a young man.
Yes.
All right. So we all know that Indiana produced a bunch of amazing riders. Can you tell us a little bit about that early scene?
Yeah, there was, what's funny is there's a lot more riders back then. There are obviously not today, but, I kind of always grew up close to Perry Mervar. My grandparents lived right across the street from him, but for some reason or another, you know, we were always really close to each other. And so the fact that he lived right across the street from them and I was always at my grandparents, you know, I was a lot younger and I had a bike. And I saw he had a bike and knew what he was doing. And then we saw BMX action one day. We were already doing tricks before that, but he got that magazine and that kind of really like sent us on our way. And so it was kind of Perry and I, you know, at that time, there were a bunch of other riders around like Jim Harvey, ramp rider, had the greatest BMX shop in Indianapolis. And from there, Steve Mulder came in. We had Jim Crafton. There's a lot of other riders, you know, Andy Cooper. Was a lot younger than us. What's funny about Andy is you gotta love this one. So a long time ago, and I'm talking like the 80s, a long time ago, and this is probably 87, 88-ish somewhere, 86 maybe even. We're riding this place called Drug Emporium on the side. It's a famous place where we grew up riding at. We learned a lot of things there. But Andy Cooper's mom and dad would drive him out there, drop him off in the parking lot, and then just leave and go across the street to the mall for like hours. And then come back over and pick him up later on in the afternoon. It was almost like we were babysitting and we were kind of like, dude, what are these people thinking, man? Just dropping this kid off here with us, you know,
these derelicts.
And it was funny, man. Like, you know, he was just kind of like a young little kid, you know, we kind of thought, oh, this dude's a little dweeb or whatever, you know, and then he started riding from watching us because he didn't really ride. He just kind of would sit there and watch. And so Steve Mulder be doing like a, what was it? He'd say something like he was doing a death truck and he's like, what do you call that? A puppet? He's like, no, man, that's when you scuff. And we're like, who is this kid? But he was from the east side, you know, and he come out there. And I think we kind of inspired him because Andy turned out to be a heck of a rider.
It's amazing.
You also got like Chris Armstrong from here. Perry Mervar and Steve Mulder. Like I said, the guys that I grew up riding with, you know, until I moved to Iowa and kind of moved away like in about 91, 92.
Now, is Perry and Steve both the same age as you?
So what's funny is right now, Steve is 52, I'm 53, and Perry's 54. And we're all like, yeah, so Steve's getting ready this coming month. He'll be 53. I'll turn 54 in September, and then Perry will turn 55 in December. So it's like we're all just kind of, you know, months apart, but within like a year of each other, as you know.
Right, right. And now where is was Kip in your area? No, he was in.
So Kip was 3 hours north of us. He was up in Angola. But we got, we kind of course Kip to come down a long time ago, you know, again, back in the late 80s, you know, when York Jam came out, we talked him into coming down here one night. We're like, yeah, come on down, man. All right. And we got him here and we're like, yeah, we're driving to York Jam and we're taking your car. And he was like 16 at the time, man. His parents didn't even like, I don't even think he'd been out of the state yet. So, or maybe the contest with his parents or something like that. But Yeah. So he was up north.
And then, of course, Danny Ming has to be mentioned. Where did he fall into this scene?
Danny Ming was actually even closer. So Danny was only like 2 hours away from us. He lived over in Centerville, which is just south of Dayton. So okay. Danny would come over. We'd go over to Centerville and ride, you know, we'd stay at each other's houses all the time and kind of grew up riding with each other. And a lot of us all met at the King of Flatland series in Columbus, Ohio, that Randy Loop, the dude that ran the AFA after Bob Morales, you know, kind of ran it for a while. Randy had that contest series, and that's where a lot of us kind of met, and that's how we met Danny Ming.
Okay. So he was part of the scene, but he wasn't as it was really Perry and Steve.
On the daily, yes. On the daily, every day from like 8 in the morning until like 3 a.m. every night, it was me and Perry and Steve.
And that's like 80s through till when would you say that kind of dissipated?
Those two, obviously Steve wrote a little bit longer. Perry went to college in 91 and he faded off by 92. He was done by 92. Steve kind of rode off and on still, you know, but kind of did the solo riding. He had a garage that he rented for a while where he could ride indoors, you know, in the wintertime. It's because obviously Indiana don't have the best weather, you know. It's real seasonal here. Even in the summertime, man, it's not always the best, you know. So he rented a place to ride indoors, you know, and I didn't get to really ride there that much or anything because obviously I was on the road doing shows.
Well, if anybody out there listening isn't familiar with Perry Merver or Steve Mulder, I highly recommend you check out these guys. There's videos online and both of them are unbelievably talented. I mean, both those guys are some of the best ever, really.
Dude, so, what we did, just the three of us, what we did in... I would say between like 87 and 92, like that 5 or 6 years right there.
Right.
Yeah, we did some pretty amazing things. I mean, just like Perry and Mervar, I'm going to throw out like tricks that Perry and Steve did, just two of the hardest ones, just to Perry team right away for Perry. And then if you looked at
that's Steve from Mulder, the rear pegs to the handlebars, right?
Yeah. Rear pegs to the handlebars. And that is not easy, man. That dude knocked himself out at least twice that I know of.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Doing that trick. And then Steve, like, man, probably honestly one of the hardest flatland tricks ever is that Superman rope-a-roni, that super rope.
Gotta be. Ridiculous.
So that's the kind of talent that I grew up riding with, you know? So I think we obviously were all feeding off each other. And that was a cool thing, you know? Not everybody got fortunate enough to ride with, you know, like, say the plywood hoods or whatever, you know? They had a whole group out there, handfuls of those dudes that got to ride every day. Here, it was like the three of us, and that was it. That was our core. You know, and we had dudes from Anderson, like Joe Miller and all those guys that came out of Anderson, that group, you know, and other groups around that would come to ride with us. But yeah, the core indie riders, you know, were the three of us.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I can't say enough about those three guys. That's an amazing scene you had, even if it's just the three of you. And so when was it, you know, when I didn't really notice you, you weren't on my radar really until Haro, I don't think. And so how did that come about? How did you get on Haro?
So I graduated in January of 1990. And by that winter, Perry and I had an idea. Like he was riding for Bully that year. And I wasn't even sponsored that year except by 2B Home Cooked Garments, Hal Brindley and Steve Budendeck. But RL offered for Perry to come out and stay at his place for the winter. And he's like, is it cool if Bill comes? He's like, sure, go ahead. And so Perry and I took off on New Year's night. We left right before it got dark or right around the time it got dark. And I think we were driving like somewhere in Missouri when New Year's happened, January of 91. So we drove out to RL's and we stayed out there for the winter. And while we were there, Pete Kearney was having that ride contest. I think it was like in Anaheim or something like that there by the Vans warehouse. So I went to that and I placed second behind Jesse Puente. And shortly after that, I got a phone call and it was Rich Hansen from Haro Bikes. And Rich was like, yo, this is Rich, you know, Haro, we'd like for you to ride for us, go over to our warehouse and pick up a bike. So the next day, dude, Perry and I hopped in his little like 1970 something Honda Buttercup Accord and we took off over to the Haro warehouse. It was like out in the middle of kind of nowhere, man. We were like, are you sure this is the place? Yeah, here it is. And I don't know, maybe a door opened up and a box slid out or something like that. I don't even know if I went into the place, you know. It's like, yeah, I'm here to pick up the bike. And it was like, yeah, cool, here it is. And so that was it, you know. I got a bike from them and rode for them. They sent me another bike. And, yeah, so 91, I rode for them until, you know, obviously until, like, that winter.
So I know, I know you more from Pulse Products and Standard, and I remember ordering stuff from you. I think it was through Pulse Products.
Yeah.
And pegs and, I don't know, t-shirts, some other crap, video. Wait, and that was before Haro. I had Vicker was living under a rock then, so.
I was probably living on your couch.
We've all lived under rocks, man. That's the BMX lifestyle.
That predated Haro, you think, for Bill?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so those years right there from, like, I think 87 to right before I got on Haro, I was riding a GT bike. You know, I was riding GT frames, you know, and forks, but I wasn't sponsored by them yet.
Hey, I want to go back to that contest that you're talking about where you did get picked up by Haro.
Oh, yeah.
Was that the same contest where Jesse, I think, was on a yellow GT and then Chase was at that contest too?
Yep.
That was a pretty epic contest.
Dude, that pro class was stacked, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it was stacked, so I was pretty stoked. That was the contest where I hit a whopper in a competition for the first time too, by the way. And Spike Jones shot that.
Well, let's talk about the whopper since you brought it up. And this is something I discuss every BMX show I do, especially if I have a guy that can do a whopper. And I give him the whole background about how this happened in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I give him the story. I'm pretty sure it's true that you invented it at a Burger King restaurant, hence the name. What else you got? Give us the story.
All right. So in 1989, the summer of 1989, all the guys we talked about, all those Flatlanders from all over Indiana, right? They all came to that place we called Drug Emporium, and we had a full-blown jam on like a weekend. I think it was like on a Saturday, and it's in the middle of summer of 89, and I'm out messing around, and there's actually, I have VHS video footage of this, okay? You can see me throughout trying to do a bunny hop tail whip in the parking lot, and I kept working on it, working on it, working on it, and 1990 comes around, and I still haven't hit it yet. And so by the, say, I think the fall, winter of 89, we quit riding at Drug Emporium and we moved over to this place, Kroger parking lot. And right next to the Kroger parking lot attached to it was a Burger King restaurant. So we rode right next to the drive-through parking lot where the drive-through is for the Burger King restaurant. We're in the parking lot that's right next to that. All right. So I'm working on it. Summer 1990. It's this one night. And it's just Perry and I. Steve isn't there. Steve is doing kind of what we called freedom riding at this time. He's kind of come and going, you know, and he's kind of like, he got burnt out a lot because he only rode flat for the most part. He rode everything, but he rode flat like hardcore consistently. Well, anyway, he was kind of burnt out at the time. So it's just Perry and I riding one night and I hit it and we both looked at each other and lost our minds. And Perry's like, yo, now you got to name it. That's a big trick, man. It's got to have a good name. And we looked over, dude, and it says Home of the Whopper right on the building. And we're like, yo, dude, a Whopper.
That's it.
And that was it. It's just that simple, dude. If you know anything about me, I'm a very simplistic person. So you don't have to dig deep to find out why I do what I do. It's just, it's right there and obvious, you know? So that was.
That's fucking beautiful, man.
The origins of the Whopper, man. If you watch, oh, by the way, if you watched the 22 Days of Double Decades that I did a few years back,
a lot
of those double decades were done in that same parking lot where I hit a whopper for the first time.
Now, could you do a tail whip jump?
So that's why I kind of started doing that. I had learned in that year in 89, I learned tail whip flyouts on the mini ramp in orbit, the 6 foot mini ramp, by the way, which is where the first two hip King of Undervert was ever held. On that same ramp, that was my home ramp, the in-orbit ramp, Jim Norton.
So you're doing fly-out tail whips, I'm assuming.
Fly-out tail whips, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I'd done any dirt jumps just yet. I learned them like later on that year also on dirt jumps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy.
Pretty epic. Do you think, the bikes, you were still on a GT, like it was before, like if you had to learn that on a standard lengthy or something, it might have been tricky.
Yeah. Well, the difference is that that lengthy or that shorty, that would have lasted through the abuse, but you know, a little bit lighter on the old school stuff, but you broke a lot of things, you know? It's like, how many times you think my headset came loose, my bars shifted, my stem twisted, my chain came loose, the back wheel shifted, the cranks bent, because we were still running one-piece cranks at the time with plastic pedals, even on the ramps, a pivot bolt broke. I mean, you go on and on and on, man, you know, about the junk I rode back then. And we just abused it. So, and what's funny now is all these collectors that are buying that crap that we broke for all that money just makes me laugh. I'm like, how much you want for that piece of crap? No. Nope.
Right. Oh, yeah. They love those old bikes. Those bikes are crappy.
Yeah. So
they love them. I don't get it either.
Oh, dude, nostalgia. The amount of times that my bars twisted on me just learning, like, tailwhip flyouts, you know, and whoppers is ridiculous.
Anthony's got a pristine pro performer or pro freestyle tour, right?
I had one. I gave it back to the guy that originally owned it.
Oh, thank you did? For doing that.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's happened to me now twice from friends of mine. And they were both, one was a GT, the one I learned whoppers on. I gave it to a buddy of mine because I always gave my bikes away when I was done with them. They were still better than anything they had, you know? And you've seen my bikes, dude. I built bikes like that since I was young, man. I always built a good looking solid bike. But yeah, I've had one buddy of mine, Wes, gave me that 90 GT back that I rode in that Just Ride contest before I got on Haro. And then my buddy TC, when I rode for GT, he gave me my 2000 Dyno Slammer back. And I'd given it, well, actually, I gave it to TC, then he gave it to another buddy, and then he gave it to another buddy, and Jim Brooks gave it back to me just this year or this past year. So that's pretty cool to do that. But I am looking for a, because I rode these and I'm rebuilding my past. I'm looking for an 87 PFT in Dayglow pink and an 88 in black.
Yeah. I had an 87 blue one, and the original owner, he was away in Korea working, and his parents were going to literally throw it into the steel bin. And I said, no, you're not. I'll take it. So I rebuilt it, cleaned it up, put some new tires and grips and new cables, and then when he came back from Korea, I gave it back to him.
Was it the Hawaiian blue or was it a darker blue?
Yeah, it was Hawaiian blue.
Oh, yeah. That's the most sought-after color in GT bikes.
Yeah. It's sick.
Yeah.
Robert Castillo's got a nice white one. I'm sure you've seen that one, Bill.
So those are in the room that I stay in when I stay at his house. I always stay upstairs in the far end. And that room has, I think, 6 or 7 bikes stacked up in it. And they
He's got a collection.
Two of them are riders, you know, two of them on the end are like, one's a Haro Yol that's still like the green. And then
he's
another
got three Yols. He's hoarding them.
Yes. And the other one is all black. It's like matte black. And it's right next to the green one. And then there's a GT. I forget what. There's a Blyther Haro in there. There's like I said,
there's
six
the FST.
Or seven. Yes.
The orange one. Yep. No platform. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are in that room that I stay in when I go out there. So I get to just like. It doesn't freak me out or anything. I just, you know, I don't like drool over looking at them. It's just kind of nostalgic to like when every time you walk in and out of that room, there they are. Because they're right inside the door and it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a collection, man. He's got a bunch of stuff in his closet, too. He's got stuff he hasn't even unboxed.
That's like me. I love going out and staying with Robert, man. It's a blast, you know, every year.
He's
obviously,
a good dude.
One Love Jam. So it's right in the middle of winter, you know, and I stay out for a week there from Wednesday to Wednesday. That way I can hang out. Get acclimated to it. Enjoy the weather. Do the Friday jam. Do the One Love jam. And then I catch HB Tuesday before I hop on the plane the next Wednesday. So, yeah, I always try to make a good time out of it.
Yeah. Well, he's got a nice, comfortable place. There's no doubt about that.
Just stepping back to the whopper. At that time, Joe Johnson invented the tail whip air, right? And that was the hottest friggin' trick going until the 900 was hit. I'm just putting it into perspective. That tail whip bunny hop was a big deal back then. I mean, kids may look at tail whip airs and stuff now and say, so what? Back then, that was the shit. That was good stuff, man.
He learned it. Well, go ahead.
It was just another trick. I was learning so many tricks. Like, I was learning tricks daily. Not one. I was learning several tricks daily. And then inventing new tricks almost like quite a bit. And that was just another one at that time. It didn't really, to me, honestly, it was cool because it was like, it took me a year to hit, you know, and that was a long time for that trick. It doesn't take me, never takes me that long to hit a trick. And so, but at that time, it was just like, it was just kind of another trick for me at the time. I didn't realize what it was going to do. I had no idea what it was going to turn into in the future. It took about a decade until like even Trevor Meyer learned it. He was one of the first ones to learn it. He's good at doing that. Like he does some really hard stuff just to do it. Like he learned parry dooms and that's hard, man. I never even tried that. I didn't even try jump a dooms. I wasn't even dumb enough to do that one. So, but yeah, thank you though. I appreciate that about the whopper. Again, at that time, it was just another trick, you know, on the daily that we were kind of going over, you know, and trying to do.
What other tricks do you claim, Bill?
All right. So Rolaid from the pedals.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
How about a roly poly? That's a Jerry Smith, a rolling Jerry Smith decade.
Okay.
There's a coffin scuff, which if you messed up, you basically like fell on your back and like you were in a coffin. That's why I called it that. If you know, like say you're doing a cyborg and you're going clockwise and you take your right leg and you stick it through can-can, and you're doing K-scuffs.
Okay,
but you're
yeah.
still stuck in the seat in the frame with your left leg up there.
Okay, you can do that?
Yeah. So if you watch that footage from, I actually did it in my contest run, that Jeff Phillips skate park footage that I just posted not too long ago, that one. Then there's the anal intruder, which is a whiplash rebate
to
your locomotive. No, I didn't name that, dude. I did not name that. When, dude, Bill Newman, we're jokers, okay? Bill was also one of those guys we spent a lot of time riding with. We grew up. Me and him and Danny Ming spent a lot of time together. Bill Newman actually called it the anal intruder because of how quick it came around. And then when I went into that locomotive, I slammed my seat right into my ass. And I think that's why he kind of came up with that. there's another one. This is probably one of the hardest ones I ever did. And I only hit it. I think I hit it twice, but, remember when Dennis McCoy did what was called a, he's rolling backwards. A buzzsaw. He did a buzzsaw. So he's pedaling backwards. He's standing on the back pegs and he kicks his pedal and turns around 180 and then goes into a rope-a-roni. All right.
Okay.
Mine was a split leg rolling over and out into a rope-a-roni, and it's a backwards rope-a-roni, and I called it a bandsaw. Those are some like the hard ones. Yeah, there was another one. Perry and I co-invented one. What was it called? We did this in the cattle company parking lot back in like 1987. I forget. There's so many. Dude, you don't realize until you go back and maybe you look at some old footage, the tricks that you did.
Mm-hmm.
I think decade from the pedals, the Nitschke decade where it's cross-footed decade up on the front pegs.
Like the Christmas tree, but it was cross-footed?
Yes, Christmas feet, by the way. I want to go ahead and give your listeners a lesson on that one. I let it go. It's funny, and I'll tell you the origins behind it and why it's called that, even when people want to dispute me on it. I'm like, dude, I named the trick. Chase
Christmas
Quinn
feet?
Christmas feet. And I'll tell you why it's called that. So that same time we're living at RL's, Chase Gwynn is also living there with us at RL's for the winter. So he's riding with us every day. And that's when he learned Christmas feet decade. And he learned it there in the parking lot at the marina down by what's called the spot. And that's where he rode at every day. So he does this trick and he's like, I go, did you name that yet? And he's like, no. And I looked and we were all wearing at the time Nike high tops with those air cushions in them.
Yeah.
And his were a emerald green Nike high top, like Christmas color green. Couldn't get any more Christmas color at all. And he put both feet on the front pegs up there on a decade, and he had those green shoes on, and I just called it Christmas feet decade. That's why it was called that.
And so somebody misinterpreted as the Christmas tree.
Everybody does it. Even my closest friends do it. And I think sometimes they do it just to mess with me.
Well, I think Chase got a bio in Ride BMX, maybe. And it was called a Christmas tree. He was doing that in the bio. You remember that?
I told you they all got it wrong.
And I'm surprised you weren't wearing British Knight shoes there, Bill. Weren't you kind of known for that?
I was.
Oh, wait, Michael Jackson, right?
I think at that time I was. And then they quit making them and I went back to them shortly after. So I wore British Knights, I think, from, or it might have been a Nikes that time. I wore British Knights in 89. I think 88, 89, 90. And then they
were sponsored
them. You know why they discontinued British Knights? I'm bummed, man. I mean, because we used to, like, we were riding in the parking lots. Dude, we'd have little gangbangers coming by all the time, you know, and threaten us. We had to run them off. And so gang members were wearing British Knights. It was a sign of gangs, and that's why they quit making them.
Oh?
Yeah.
Really?
Thanks a lot, gangs. Bloods and Crips. Thanks, man. Yeah, you killed off the best riding shoes in the history of Flatland or BMX in general, you know?
Was anyone else wearing British Knights? I mean, I know you did. I know you did, Bill.
I'm sure some people did, but I don't know who. I was too busy riding around to look at their shoes, you know?
Oh, shit. All right, Christmas feet. That's going to be hard for me to adjust to Christmas feet. I don't know.
Another one was the Ton Decade, the Tower of Nitschke. That's the one where I'm standing in the middle of a deck. I did a double on it, but I'm standing on top of the tire, the front tire, with one foot, and one foot's kicked out. You can't get any higher up on a decade than that. I mean, let's do like, you know, standing on the bike.
And you called that what now?
A ton, decade, T-O-N, Tower of Nitschke. Because I was in the tower of the bike. I mean, it's the size you can get. That was
fun decade. Dude,
do you want to know what's funny is? So on Double Decade Day a few years back when I did that, I was getting stressed out because, you know, I always try to come up with a new double every, you know, year for the Worldwide Double Decade Day. And it was raining out. It was humid. I was hot. I started at one place. I wasn't able to hit it there. And I went to another place that I'd never rode at before. And it was just on this patio of this restaurant that had just closed down. And it was just enough room for cover and everything like that. And man, I tried and tried and tried. And I was doing that stall decade. There's another one where you do decade off the pedal stalled. That's another one I did. Where you're stalled and I jumped from the pedals to that ton decade. And then I did a perverted after that. So that was the first time I actually hit that was in a double.
So there was a decade. So the first one's a stall decade and the second one around the Smith.
The second one around was just a regular perverted, but I went from the pedals on the first one.
So and I the second one's off the
stall
pegs.
On the pedals, went from the pedals and did that ton decade up on that. And then came around to the back pegs and perverted out of that again. But
wow,
dude, I was dedicated to that. Another one I did in Roman Chevarelli's garage a few years back that I'd never done. And I did it in his garage because it was raining out, you know. And I don't start on these. None of those, by the way, all the double decades that I do on Worldwide Double Decade Day are shot on Worldwide Double Decade Day. I don't pre-record that somewhere in January and hope for the best by February or March or April or May or June or even like even like October 9th, man. God, I finally hit it. It took me all
That's
year.
A great idea, though.
No, it's a great idea. I know some people that do that, dude. I don't do that, man. I go out on the day of and I do a double decade.
I've struggled on double decade days. I got one last year, though.
Oh, dude. Last year in October, I was hurt. My hips were hurting so bad.
I can't imagine with your hips.
Well, the twisting and everything that I do to get some of these unique ones that I like to throw in, it was so hard just to jump and plant and switch feet. And I was lucky just to get a regular double coming out.
Just popping Advil like candy.
Oh, man. I mean, no, I don't. I never use that. No.
Wow.
I got a real high pain tolerance. I only take that stuff. I got a headache and I rarely get a headache. If I feel like I'm dying, then I'll take, you know, some painkillers or something like that, you know, but yeah, like some oxycodone or some hydrocodone. But I don't take that unless I feel like I'm going to die.
Yeah, it's probably not good for you.
No.
Kills pain.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good stuff. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about
20 more to go. You guys don't know what I'm talking about. But,
let's switch gears. How about let's talk about Rampage. That's a legendary bowling alley skate park in Davenport. I know you were a regular there. What can you tell us about that in that time?
So Rich Hansen was from Minnesota. So he was friends with Kurt Schmidt, you know, and all those guys from up that way. And that was kind of the tie-in connection there. However, I've been going to Rampage contests since, I think 89 and, you know, got to obviously know everybody, got to be real good friends with Rick. We went there, whether it was a contest or not, you know, just to stop through in the middle of winter or whatever, you know, and hit him up. I think some of the first times we went out there, this is back when we had phone booths and phone books in the phone booths. The first time I went there, we were coming back. I'm not even kidding. Perry and I were driving back from Cali in winter of 91. After I just got picked up and we were like, yo, let's just go to this place we call it. We heard about, or maybe it was even before that. I can't remember. But anyway, we were there and it's like, we looked up Rick's number in the phone book, dude, and called.
Wow.
And he had like an old message, like an old answering machine. We're like, yo, we're in town, man. It's probably like 2 or 3 in the morning, by the way. You know, we're like ringing this dude up and we don't even know if it's his phone number or not. But anyway, that was kind of how I ran into, you know, Rampage, obviously going to the contest and then. Once I got picked up on Haro, I was ready to get out and just go. And I was thinking about going back out west again for the winter because it was kind of getting towards the fall. And Rick's like, dude, just move in here. You can live right here in the bowling alley. Here, I got a room for you, man. You know, there's nothing in the room, obviously. It's just like it was the old pro shop or something that used to be in there, part of it. And so I moved in there and rode there that winter. And I was there maybe like 2 months or something like that. And I had Pulse Products at the time. I was selling, doing great, man. I mean, it was like the industry leading company in components. And he came in one morning and woke me up because he worked at UPS at the time as a stock guy or whatever. And he goes, hey, man, I got a frame design and you got some You got the number one components in the market. Let's put a bike company together. But before we do that, let's go to Haro first and see if they would like to let us change some things and maybe set up a tour, and they can pay us a certain amount of dollars, and we'll do that. And if they don't, then we'll start a company. I was like, all right, sounds good to me, man. You know, I'm ready for a tour. That's what I want to do. But making products is just part of something that was a necessity that we needed, because if we didn't make it, I wasn't going to keep doing this, man. You know, two or three sets of thread on pegs a day was not going to cut it anymore. So obviously, you know, Haro said no. He started Standard, and Rick's like, ah, we need a third person if we have a, you know, a disagreement about something. I'm like, dude, I was only 21 at the time. I was a kid living my life, you know. I just want to ride my bike. And I was like, sure, whatever, you know. And I didn't even think about it. Nowadays, I'm like, eh, third person is too much. That third wheel's not going to work. But either way, that's kind of how that started. And I lived in the park for a little while longer until Kurt and Jamie McParland moved out. And then we moved out into an apartment and lived there until we got kicked out of that. And then moved in with some other girls. Like, I was like, all right, you guys do whatever you're doing, man. There's some chicks that live there. And I was like, I'm going to move in with you girls. And I think they live right below us. So I didn't have to move my stuff but down one flight of stairs. I didn't have that much anyway, man. I was living in a skate park.
Yeah, I'd rather live with girls than BMX dudes.
But I'm going to tell you, man, I really do have to. I mean, for that time, before the Standard thing, getting to live in Rampage and the accessibility that I had 24/7, just with the lights on day or night, whether you were there or nobody was there or it was whatever was going on, I could go out there and ride. And I had full access to that anytime I wanted. And that was what was really cool. So I do appreciate that, you know, that he was just like, yeah, come on out here, man, move in the park, you know. And maybe that motivated him too, because obviously at that time, I think he started riding a lot more, man, and he turned up his game. And that's when we started riding a lot of mini ramp and doing a lot of like invention. Like, dude, there's tricks. We were just talking about flatland tricks that I invented. There are tricks on ramps that I've invented also, you know, that people aren't even still doing to this day yet. So there's a lot of stuff that I took to that game as well. Obviously, you know, the vert ramp wasn't, you couldn't go very high in there. It was 8 foot tall. It got cut down to a mini ramp too. But dude, that's when spine ramps started to take off. We built one in there and it was 6 foot tall. Extensions, double coping spine, platforms. We had everything we needed in there. So it was ramp sessions during, you know, the evenings, flatland sessions in the day. Then we moved to the other place and moved all the ramps from that one over to the Kimmel Drive. Chris Young moved out and lived with me with those chicks in that apartment for a while. Until I left. But dude, Chris and I would ride all day until the park closed around 8 or 9 at night. And then we go ride the ramps all night until we were tired. And then we get up and be out in the parking lot again the next day in the morning, dude, riding all day again. So it was just, it's a great time, dude. I do appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate everything that everybody's ever done for me, you know, especially giving me a place to ride like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it must've been awesome. I mean, we were watching it in videos and thinking, wow, you know, like, how awesome would that be?
Peter Pan, well, lifestyle, baby.
Let me back up a little bit. I feel like I kind of rolled over this question. Back to Anthony. I remember, I guess before you got on Haro, he ordered some stuff from you. And I vividly remember this because I think I got a T-shirt out of the deal. But yeah, you ordered a video. And yeah. I guess, was that Pulse or was that Indie Industries?
Straight out of Indie.
Straight out of Indy. That was it.
And so you were doing a lot. You came out with these socket on pegs, which are arguably the first that were really available. Maybe Uni did some.
Havoc. Havoc was the other one. And I had a set of the Havoc socket on pegs, and they weren't anywhere near the quality of the Pulse. They were like welded on, two piece, like. They were, and with grip tape wrapped around them, no finish. Right. Like they were,
the Pulse were like knurled, or they had the round
threaded
and chrome.
Yep.
They were way nicer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about that, what you were producing. Cause I mean, I know you did a bunch of stuff, the pegs, the unbrake, the bars, forks. Tell us about that.
It all started out with the pegs. That's where it started out. And again, it was something that the bolt-on peg wasn't, I didn't invent that. I mass produced that idea that worked. Nobody's had worked yet. All right. And here's what I mean by that. There was really a couple people that did it at that time. The first person I ever saw do it was Air Uni. Uni did it, and they were called tailpipes. Big diameter, but very stubby, kind of like the old, like early 80s Hutch fork pegs, you know, that were like an inch long. Those bolted on. those unis bolted on, but they didn't catch on because they were so big and goofy. It was just a chunk of stuff. You had platforms.
They were like 3-inch diameter. They were huge.
They were big. And they were thick gauge steel too. Good idea, obviously, but it didn't work for that. The way they did it didn't work. And then Perry moved out to York and I think lived with Mark Eaton for the summer. And Brian Ulrich made burt pegs out of stainless steel. He, I don't know if he had somebody or somebody worked at a shop or whatever. He had a few sets made for some of the guys out there and wasn't wanting to make any more mass produce or anything like that. Perry came back that summer and I was like, wow, those are cool, man. He's like, yeah, they go in with the socket, you know? And I'm like, all right, cool. And can I get any? No, you can't get them. I was lucky just to get this pair right here. And I was like, dude, I'm sick of stripping pegs. So I went and had a buddy of mine that worked at Greenwood Schwinn. He worked at Greenwood Schwinn, then worked over at one of my other buddies' machine shops just up the street. And I had to make me a set of pegs. And my God, I still have them. They were heavy. I put them on the front and that's what started it. And then once I started going to contests, people were like, yo, can I get some of these? And I was like, yeah, let me get home and I'm going to make some. And I started out making 15 sets. Then like, I think I made like 18 sets and then I made 20 and 25 and 30 and 35. And the numbers went from there, but it started out with that. And I made a space thread and a tight thread. That's where the peg started. Then next was the Unbreak. Pete Brandt, Danny Ming. God, I wish I had all day to tell this story. Anyway, Danny Ming went out to the West Coast to ride with Eric Emerson and Pete Brandt and came back with what was called an Unbreak that Pete found to turn your coaster brake into a free coaster. This is already out by a company that was doing this, but they made them out of plastic so they wouldn't last. I tried it and loved it. And I was like, dude, I got to make this. And I made it out of steel. And then I mass produced those and made them out of steel so they would fit three different styles of Suntour hubs. And that's what turned your Suntour hub into a free coaster. And that, I ran that hub forever until I changed, I don't know, maybe like 15, 20 years ago. And I went to that Nankai Technolite with the profile shell. Then I run the Z coaster now. I've only ran three hubs when it comes to free coaster style my whole life.
So Suntour for years.
Yeah, Suntour longer than anything.
Yeah, yeah. Those and were like gold, man. Anybody that rode back then remembers the challenge in trying to find a Suntour coaster brake. It was easy.
No, and it's, dude, you might find one and it might have like 18 holes in it.
You have to drill it out, get new flanges, or take one from a mag wheel.
I'm still to this day looking for hub guts and new flanges or, flanges that are decent. Because, dude, we pitted them all. All the bearing races pitted. So once you felt that crunchy or you saw your wheel fluttering a little bit, you're like, oh, man, you know how you can never get, no matter how brand new those are, they're never 100% tight or they're over tight. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I think I got one from Standard, or maybe it was Basic.
That was the one piece shell that I invented also.
You did that?
That
was great.
I still have the original first one. Okay. I still have the original pair of hand grenades, the reason they're called hand grenades.
Yeah. Were they Standard? They were Standard or indie pegs?
They were Standard pegs. So that hand grenade was the first step peg that I made that would fit onto your dropouts, come out far enough and then clear your fork leg to go to a bigger diameter. Because at that point you can only go with the smaller pegs because nobody made anything. Yeah. So that was another thing that I did invent in the industry was that step on the pegs.
And but that came out as a Standard product.
Yeah. The next product
that was after Pulse basically, right?
Yeah. That started. Well, actually that was an Indie Industries product that failed. I had a guy making them at a shop and I said, it's got to be one piece. This is what I want to do. And he made it three pieces thinking that he knew more than I did. I'm like, dude, I don't care what kind of engineer you are. I ride this crap. I know what needs to be made and what needs to be done. And he didn't do that. So that got postponed. That happened right before I moved to Iowa and we started Standard. So that was already in progress. I was also at that time making 24 thread coaster brake axles and heat treating them because.
Okay.
Yeah, anybody that had that and pegs, you were breaking them,
or bending them.
Steel axles or bent them or stripped them. So I made a stronger axle and then I started making super pro axles, obviously. And then I made axles for up to like 6 or 9 different bike companies or something like that. Because the racers, I'm kind of jumping out there, but the racers that were starting to transform over into riding street had to change their wheels because they had short axles on their wheels, the race wheels, right?
They couldn't run pegs.
they couldn't run pegs. They had to get another set of wheels. They didn't do that. They wouldn't do that. So I made longer axles for race hubs at that time. So the street riders could run the same stuff, just pull their nuts off, put the pegs on and go. And there were a lot of racers that rode my stuff. And I was pretty stoked about that, man. Dude, seeing Freestyle products up on the race gate was awesome.
Right.
And then obviously Straight Outta Indy came out. Anything that I did after that, you know, the frames, the forks, any of that stuff, that came at standard. But as far as components go, dude, I already had the whole line set. I did, you know, I gave everything to standard and I got nothing from it. Dude, yeah. even the frame design was somebody else's outside of standards. So
learn about that, kids, you know.
Hey,
go in business for yourself.
That was progress in parts. Like, you're not kidding when you said every day you're stripping pegs. And,
hey,
and every fucking day it was like a scramble to, I got a strip peg. Who's got a peg? Can we hacksaw this one down so there's some good threads in it? And like,
we could get these pegs at Canadian Tire and they're just distributed across Canada. Yeah. And they would have the 26 and the 24 thread. And of course, you'd run the 26, you'd strip, and then you just strip on your 24 thread.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you're running coaster brake, and you put your pegs on the front, and you strip the front one, you just put it to the back.
Right. Because it's a different.
You just swap them out, man. You know, if you're running the same thing on the back. They had it on each side, threaded 24 on one side and 26. They still do that, like, in the stores today. Those junky pegs they make, make those.
Why, I don't know.
But, because nobody else does either. That's why they're not in our industry.
Well, thanks for all those parts, man, because I use the hell out of those standard axles. And
everything was out of necessity, you guys. Everything was out of necessity, man.
I mean, that was nobody so was going to
do it. Dude, really, nobody wanted to do it. Can you believe Haro turning down my brain?
Well, it was during the dark ages, right? It was when the industry was kind of at a lull. And
that tell you about our vision? Like, at that time, my vision for the sport, dude, was immense. Like, that was... When standard happened, man, obviously Pulse Products was running, you know, when standard happened, that was my ultimate, like, that was it right there. I thought that was really going to be the one, and it didn't, you know? And so again, it's just kind of one of those things, man. It didn't happen for a good reason, but well,
so how long, reasons, but. How long would you say that you were on standard before you decided to switch over to, I guess, Homeless, right?
You mean how long did I own standard?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. How long did you own standard before you gave it away?
That's a dagger. You know how many people came up to me after I left and were like, oh, man, I can't believe you got kicked off standard. And it's like, how do you get kicked off your own company that you started?
Right.
You'd have to be a real nerd, man.
Both you and me, Bill, we have job security because nobody can fire me from the Freestyle Connection.
I was riding my bike for the rest of my life, regardless of what I was doing, you know.
All right, let me rephrase that question. How long before you, I don't know, walked away
from that winter of 91 to the, I think it was like that next winter of 92. It was a full year, pretty much, yeah. Okay. And it was pet, dude. It was. We don't have time to go into the petty stuff that was going on behind my back and, you know, the deceit and everything else that was happening, man. And the lies that followed long after I left that traveled all over the world, man. I mean, it wasn't cool. That's one of the main reasons I quit going to contests. I got tired of hearing people's mouths about stuff they didn't know about and, you know, the people that were followers and just had no clue. People that aren't even around anymore, man. You know, it's just, if it's not fun, I'm done. And that's why I stopped going to contests around the mid-90s. It just wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah, I looked it up, and I could see there's a lot of indications that you were riding Stuntman, which would be pro class in the BS series, 92 and 93. Were you still competing after that, or are you, like you said, you pretty much walked away from contests at that point?
By 98, I was done.
98, yeah. So there's 5 years that you were still...
I didn't compete a whole lot in that in the last few there, you know. I started a family, got married at that point and everything. So that took up a lot of time. And I was just kind of like, you know, I want to get away from the bike. And I was doing indie industries at the time, but I was trying to focus more also on, you know, getting back to doing shows again full time as well.
Well, so before we get into the show biz, because I definitely want to get into that. Yeah. I mean, I think most of us know that you were on Homeless for a while. How did that happen? Is that just after you walked away from Standard?
They came around right when I kind of needed it, man. So right after I left Standard and went back to Indy, you know, I obviously knew all the guys, you know, I know I was great friends with James and Ruben and Greg Hansen and all the guys, teen, everybody down there at Trim Bike Source, because I've been selling them products and they've been buying the crap out of my products for years. So they loved what I was all about, you know, and as soon as they heard that I was off, I forget who it was that called me up. But they were like, yo, man, we want you to ride for Homeless. And I was like, cool. And this was in 93, by the way. So this was the following year, or maybe it was like the following. Yeah. Yeah. It was the following year, right? 93. And I think I went to scrap and I was on a brand new bike. I think I don't remember if it was Jay or Dave. This year, Jay or Dave, one of them came up, man. And I told them, you know, because they'd heard a bunch of crap, you know, that was going on. There were so many rumors going on about after I left, and the internet wasn't around at that time. So it was all what somebody said, he or she said. It was in magazines. There was so much misinformation at that time, and it was in print, something that you couldn't really track or anything like that. But there were a lot of people that heard when I left, came up and were like, man, thank you. I'm so glad you left. It was the best thing you could have ever done. That was a bad scene that you were in. Those guys suck. And, you know, I'm really happy for you. And I was on Homeless. And so I rode a Homeless for a short period of time. And then I helped get Basic started right after that. I don't know if you knew that one, but
no, I didn't know you were involved. Well, of course they were Standard bikes they were riding. So yeah, tell us
Darcy
about that.
And Cecil. Yeah. Darcy and Cecil hit me up and they're like, yo, man, we heard that, you know, the guys at Standard kind of stiffed the manufacturer that you were using down there that you got them all set up with. And, man, we want to kind of maybe help out. They didn't like Rick or I don't know if there was – they just didn't like Standard, what was going on. And so what they did was I got them in touch with Dave Gardner at the time. And I said, hey, man, these guys are going to be hitting you up to buy some stuff, maybe work a deal out or something like that. So – they bought up all the stuff that Rick had stiffed this dude on. He already had everything cut, bent, ready to weld and manufacture and fabricate. It was already ready to go, man. It was just weld it and go. And Rick stiffed this dude on it. So Basic came in and bought all that up. So I helped Basic get started.
No shit. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Dave was a good guy.
I knew it was old Standard stuff, but I didn't realize the connection there. Cool.
So when I did Indie Forks and was doing Indie Industries and I made my Indie Forks, I had Dave make them. So I was traveling from Indy all the way out to Iowa to pick up my forks from him. He was so good. And I love what he did. And he was such a great guy. I gave him my business, you know, and I traveled 5 hours just to pick up forks each way.
Well, that stuff was well made. I mean, you look at the original Standards or the Basics, they're a little beefier than the Standards.
Yeah, we made it that way, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's kind of how, you know, so I don't know. The Homeless thing happened after the Standard thing happened, and they kind of got me back on my feet with that.
So Greg was the guy that owned the shop that was making the Basic frames?
No, that was Dave Gardner, the guy that was making the Standard. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He was making.
Did Basic continue working with them? Because later on, they had different, you know, renditions.
I think for a short while, but then probably what happened is, you know how, if you've ever, well, you're from Canada, man, you know exactly what I'm talking about, dude. The Canadians love to get you one way or another going across your border.
All right.
Duty charges, buddy. I'd like to buy your stuff, but I'm in Canada. Would you please write gift on the shipping docket? So I don't have to pay taxes on it.
I probably asked you that when I ordered from you. You have my gift on there.
You're not the only one. Everybody, I think, from out of the U.S. did that. And I would oblige you, man, because I thought it was ridiculous when I heard how much people got charged. Like, it was more than what the cost sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's still.
I was like, what? That's ridiculous. You're not making it in your country and you want it from ours. You should pay me extra to get it over there. Come on.
What happened to free trade, right?
Yeah. That's what, hey, man, I was just, give me what I want for it and it's yours. You know, that's it. I didn't, all the extras was just BS to me, you know. I felt bad. So I was like, yep, gift. Or 2 cents. But yeah. So that's kind of how that happened. That was, you know,
that's
great. Time.
That's great. That's good to know. I'm sure there's some Canadian listeners out there that'll be stoked to hear that. So let's go to your showbiz. When did you start doing that? And I think you posted something that you have been doing shows for 40 years. Is that right?
Yeah, since 1984. I've done shows every year of my life since 1984. And not just one or two here and there. I mean, I've done shows and I've been touring throughout that time.
Well, you're like, a show whore. We know it.
I just love it. Hey, dude, come on, man. Who did I tell you that like got me inspired to pop wheelies? Evel Knievel. That guy went out just to show off. And I was a shy guy, you know, like I was a shy kid always until I got on my bike and I realized like, dude, the confidence that I had riding my bike, it made everything else confident. And that kind of just came together, blended together from riding a bike. But I love showing off, man. Shows are a great, great feeling I get when I do that. You know, when you can inspire people, like if I could inspire one kid to do what I did just by me popping a wheelie on the seat, man, I made it. You know what I mean? I made it.
When did you start Wonder Wheels?
So Wonder Wheels happened in 2001. Just, I had an agent that was booking an East Coast tour and I was going, you know, I just kind of threw the name. We were going under Indie Industries, you know, like GT Bikes or Haro Bikes or any, you know, Schwinn or anybody like that. They didn't have like a special name for their team, you know, that they'd send out. They just went by the company name and I just did Indie Industries, you know, I was Bill Nitschke. That's what you're getting, you know, in my team. There wasn't any fancy name. And I had an agent. She's like, hey, man, I'm putting this East Coast tour together. And these people want a name that really is like got the wow factor in it, you know? And I was like, okay, well, give me a minute here to brainstorm something. And dude, you're going to love this because it ties into what I'm doing tomorrow, by the way. So anyway, I was like, man, what do they want? What's the wow factor here? And I was like, what about Wonder Wheels BMX, you know? And the reason I came up with that was Richard Pryor did a movie called The Toy a long time ago. And one of the opening scenes, he's in that inflatable carnival looking wheel. It's dying on because it's deflating while he's playing on it in that supermarket. And he's like, he's a janitor. And he's like, it's dying on him. He's going, don't die on the Wonder Wheel. Don't die on me. And
this great
guy's son is in town and he sees him, you know? And so anyway, it was hilarious at that point. And I was like, yo, Wonder Wheels BMX. Richard Pryor was the star in that. I'm doing shows in Peoria, Illinois tomorrow, where Richard Pryor grew up and lived and is from. So I think that's pretty funny. You know? So that's where Wonder Wheels came from. And I just ran with it and it turned into something just as a joke, dude. And that's been going on for what, 23, 24 years now.
That's interesting. You know, Richard Pryor grew up in a brothel. You know, that's
yeah. Funny? Yeah. His mom worked downstairs.
Yeah.
I know, dude. Come on, man. I know Richard Pryor's story.
Fucking hell of a story, man. Hell of a story. Amazing comic. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. So that was 2001 you started that.
Yeah.
Wonder Wheels.
Yeah. And just kind of ran with that name, you know, and just left it and it kind of grew, you know. It's not like Trick Stars, you know, or, you know, BMX Trick Stars or, you know, the freestyle team or anything like that, you know. It's just.
As well as I do, that none of these schools remember. They're just like,
the BMX. BMX. And that's why I put BMX in there. Because somewhere it says BMX right in the middle of it. The actual full name is Wonder Wheels BMX Stunt Team Worldwide. The BMX is dead center in those five letters, dude. If you know me,
Robert had it figured out. He calls his team BMX Freestyle Team.
Yes.
He can't get any more generic than that. But he might be genius there doing that, you know.
BMX Pros. Tricks. Yeah, man. I mean, it's the Freestyle Connection. I mean, where are you going to get connected at? With John Dowker at the Freestyle Connection. That's what I'm saying, man.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. Well, that's awesome, man. 40 years of fucking having a good time because BMX shows are awesome. I love doing them. That's a great job.
Tell me, like, I mean, would you rather go and sit in a cubicle and have some dude over your neck every like 5 minutes asking for those TPS reports?
I just watched Office Space literally 2 days ago. And
I had a job once. I had a job once, dude. Never ever again once.
What did you do? What did Bill do for a job?
Oh, my God. You ready? Okay. I worked at the Shoe Carnival. Do you know what the Shoe Carnival is?
Yeah. Did you get a discount on your British Knights?
They didn't carry British Knights.
Ah.
No, they didn't carry British Knights. I had to go to the mall for those, man. They're one of those fancy foot places, you know, those fancy shoe stores. And they weren't big back then. I worked at the Shoe Carnival. I started out, you know, like just kind of working in the aisles, you know, facing off the shoe boxes, making them look flat and everything. And, hey, what are you looking for? Can I help you out? They're over here. And eventually – the dude put me on the microphone because this place, it's a carnival. They have somebody standing up on a platform with a wheel that you spin for deals. They got a microphone that you're announcing through the entire store, specials throughout, and you're announcing every like 90 seconds you're on the microphone. And so that's where I kind of got the microphone start at. And this dude taught me one thing, man, because, you know, I talk a lot and I spit a lot of words quick, but he taught me how to enunciate, man. He goes, listen, He goes, you can say a lot, but nobody understands what you're saying. He goes, I want you to enunciate. And I was like, what's that? He's like, make sure that when you speak, your words are crispy and clear and that everybody can understand every single word that comes out of your mouth. And that really helped launch me into being able to speak a lot clearer and cleaner, you know, and just sounding better when I would talk to people.
Yeah, like so, a carny, like a carny ride. You got to get those kids.
That was the only real job I ever had, man. I was done with that in the 80s. I bounced.
Well, hey, I got this job kind of from Greg Overstreet. I don't know if you know that name. He's a writer from Athens. All right. And yeah, and he shifted from BMX shows to working at a strip club. And he's got all the skills on the microphone to do that. Like,
all right, welcome. Gentlemen, put your hands together. Doublers out, Pervert Row. It's an all-skate. We got Lexus Mercedes.
Telling you, dude.
We got Sexy Chocolate coming up next. Ow! Oh, dude.
You'd be good for it.
Adam Strebe, I think, worked in a strip club as the DJ announcer also. He's a Strebe from Northern. You know the Strebe brothers, buddy. Brian, Adam, and Nathan. Those guys are BMX legends in Northern Indiana when it comes to dirt and racing and street park. They ran Blindside Skate Park here in Indy for a long time.
Okay. Yeah, I remember those names. Yeah. Strebe. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Strebe brothers.
They got their skills there on the mic from BMX shows, I'm sure, right? As well.
You never know.
No, maybe not. No.
I don't know. Maybe.
We can pretend.
I shoot it's kind of funny.
Shoe carnival. Yeah.
You'd understand how weird it would be for one of them or any of them to end up in a strip club working or visiting, even.
Oh, they're pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty,
and not in a million years.
Kind of square. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's too bad for them. Moving on. All right, Bill. This is amazing to me because I did work in the field for a while, and I know you're very meticulous about your equipment. And you're organized that way. And you have a GMC Denali. I don't know what year it is. I think it's 90-something.
03.
An 03. Okay. And you have over 500,000 miles on this engine.
552,000.
Never been rebuilt. At least not the bottom end. I did go to your house one time, and I think you had the heads off and valves all over your workbench. which was awesome. But yeah, it's amazing, dude. Like, it's a GMC with over 500 and how many? 552,000?
552 on that one.
And it's still going down the road.
That's my daily driver. Dude, I don't even take the new truck out to go get groceries or run down the street for anything. I drive the old truck.
Well, and what's the secret?
Well, I'm a good mechanic. I mean, I'm not kidding you, man. What happens to most people? They wait until they hear it clunking and chunking, and then they're like, I heard something. Fix it. Sorry. That was your rod bearings that you threw right there, you know, through the oil pan and your rod. Yeah, no, it's too late at that point, man. Routine maintenance is key, dude. There's certain things that you're going to have go out all the time. And in my case, what's funny is a lifetime product for most people is every 2 to 3 years. I think NAPA changed their warranty because of me, because I was changing. Like, I bought parts.
Lifetime that truck. Warranty on brake pads.
Dude.
I've been in there 15 times.
I bought parts of that truck once a long time ago, and I haven't bought parts for it since because I get to replace them because they had a great warranty. And they realized that my lifetime warranty was worth 2 years. And so they changed their warranty now from lifetime to a limited, and they call it 2 years now. Which I was turning parts in every 2 to 3 years because I was wearing through them that quick.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, man. I got 334,000 on the old Dodge right now, which I thought was impressive, but it's got nothing on you. So.
I hadn't even rebuilt my transmission at that mileage yet.
Really? That's impressive. Pulling that trailer too. That's impressive.
350, and I just did that just for routine maintenance. It wasn't.
I'm on my third transmission.
Oh yeah.
There you go.
It is a Dodge. It is a Dodge, though.
It is a Dodge. I mean, things falling apart interior-wise, but
I had a Dodge van.
Yeah, they're good.
I got a Dodge van sideways one time. It was pretty awesome. I had it. It was three on the tree, too, by the way. It was an old Dodge with an old extension on the back of it.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. It was primer-colored red.
Cool.
Or what they would call matte red these days.
I want to get the hardware from an old Dodge van and basically put a 5-speed transmission in one. I just think that that would be neat to do. But
dude,
get a shorty.
Get one of those short vans, man. There's all kinds of Dodge short vans. I've seen like two or three in the last few days.
I want one shorty, and I want to put a 5-speed out of a Dodge truck in there and get a 360 Magnum engine. That's kind of my dream.
Oh, wow. There you go.
And lower it a little bit. Dodgy Ben. I don't know if you've seen this thing. They do it in Japan, and they race these vans. It's awesome. Anyways, I'm a weirdo. But I love it. Yeah, I love it.
Nah, that's
anyways, cool, this is your podcast, not mine. How many kids you got, Bill?
Four.
Four kids. And what are their ages?
So Gia is 27 right now. Pete's 22. Josie's 19. And she turns 20 on April 1st. She's an April Fool's Day. So like this coming next week, she turns 20. And then Angela is 18. And he's a senior this year. So he's only got like, I think, a few more weeks of school. He's on spring break right now. So I'm going to be an empty nester at the end of this, at the end of this spring.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. Okay. You got started young.
I had my first at 26. Yeah. In 19. Yeah. Wait a minute. That was, 1996. Yep.
Wow. Okay.
So I was 26 at the time, you know? So yeah. That's not too bad. I'm glad I didn't wait till later, man. I got friends with kids that are young right now, even Volker right now, but he's got three that are young. And he's
How many kids does Volker have? He's got kids with a lot of women.
Five. He's got five.
Jeez.
Yeah. But that's going to keep him going, man. That'll keep you young. Like a lot of the dudes I hang out with are a lot younger than I am, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That's just because my friends at my age can't keep up with me, though. That's why.
You are full throttle, man. For somebody your age, it's an ex-girlfriend of mine, she was like, I think he's on cocaine. He's got to be on cocaine. I'm like, no.
Never done it in my life.
He doesn't do cocaine. He's just high on life, this guy.
It would have a negative effect on me, dude. I think it would bring me down.
It'd be too much. It'd be too much. Well, hey, I'm just going to bring this up because I think it's funny. One time I went to hang out with you at a bar, and I was with Andy Cooper because I'm tight with Andy Cooper. And I just want to bring this up because obviously it was a bar that you frequented at the time. And I don't know, Andy was having a bit of an issue and I got lippy with the bartender. And next thing you know, the bouncer's got me by the scruff of my shirt. He's picking me up. I'm off my feet. and he's laughing, but he's carrying me out the fucking door of the, like, he's kicking me out. And I think the only reason he didn't hurt me is because you told him not to. I do remember as he's kicking me out, I had a full beer that I dumped over his head. And I'm like,
oh no,
I probably shouldn't be doing this right now because he could really hurt me. And I got thrown out the door about 15 feet. And then that was the end of the night at that bar, anyways. Do you remember that?
I do. You're lucky they didn't have to break out the pressure washer and, mop your blood off the sidewalk out there like some people.
I'm thinking the only reason he was like easy on me is because he knew you, or you told him, hey, he's cool, just throw him out.
100% correct.
So thanks. Thanks for that.
That's the slippery noodle. So real good friends of mine owned that bar until just this recently past year. Hal Yagi passed away, who was the owner. Josh Kaplinger and his brother Brian Yagi. They were the sons of Hal, and so they ran the bar. But at that time, and this is, oh, man. So this is basically like, that was the only bar that I really ever go to. It's downtown Indy. It's the oldest bar in Indiana. It's a Slippery Noodle Inn. That place is where we go. Yes. Oh, like, yeah. It was great times there. Anyway, the person that night, and we were sitting at the front bar, and you're sitting right next to me. And it was either... There's a couple dudes in there that you don't have to say much to when it comes to the bartenders there. Even when you're with somebody that they know real well, you say the wrong thing, man, and you got right under their skin real quick, you know?
It wasn't much. Something.
No, it wasn't much. It wasn't much. And
Coops wasn't happy, and I was kind of like with Coops on it.
I'm pretty sure I know. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know who it was. It was probably Eric Perkins. Even with me, buddy, he had a short leash, you know, sometimes. So anyway. You said something, somebody came by or something like that. You probably said something to one of the bouncers, and Marty Bacon, I got a shout out to Marty Bacon because he's the general manager. He's still there and he's been there forever. He runs that noodle. All right. super nicest guy, but this dude is something out of, what's that movie with Sean Connery back in the day where they had swords and everything like that? And they were, it was the medieval days or something. You know what I'm talking about. You know so that
Lancelot?
Movie.
I don't know.
Something like that, except they like, I don't know. Anyway.
Outlander is what's coming to my head.
Yeah. Would you say Zoolander?
Outlander.
Outlander, yes. Yeah. Zoolander's just good. But Outlander's yeah. exactly. So imagine Marty Bacon is one of those dudes, okay? He's a massive Viking-style type of guy. He's big like that, all right? Long, flowing hair. He's a leather jacket. He's not a bouncer. He's the general manager. Oh. You attracted the attention of the general manager, okay? That doesn't happen very often, I'll tell you that much. He usually has his buddies do the work, but you got under his skin. He picked you up, dude. Like you say, he picked you up, and I was laughing the whole time.
I was off my feet.
I had just don't kill him, man. I gave him that look. I was like, just don't kill him. Well, he came back after he threw you out there, and he goes, hey, Bill, I'm just going to tell you something, man. You tell your buddy that he is really fortunate that you were with, or he was with you tonight, because anybody else would have done what he just did to me, and he wouldn't have gotten up. But
I dumped my beer on his head.
I was like, oh my God, dude.
It's like, fuck you, buddy. You're not kicking me out of your damn bar. Take that.
I brought a lot of people to that noodle, man, and like, you topped it.
I've got my ass beat a lot.
Yeah, we had no idea that we were that close to everybody.
I can remember a few times Dicker writing checks he couldn't cover.
And, several times, yeah, man.
Oh, when growing up in Peterborough, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing that I'm here.
Hey, let's get in a padded room and get drunk. What do you think?
All right. There's kids listening to this podcast, maybe. So, all right. That's why I'll move on.
I'm G-rated, baby.
I've got questions for Bill Nitschke. So let's get started with the reader mail. We're starting off with a fellow named Danny Bridges. You familiar?
Yep. He's the guy that hires me for the Colts games and like freelance, like in the TV industry.
Oh, no kidding. All right. Cool.
I just do that like on the side.
So he was, he's like, ask Nitschke, when growing up, did he ever think that he'd steal some of my moves and get paid for it?
Oh, man. I'll tell you what, you and Danny Bridges would have a great time together. John, you have a great time together. He's pretty funny, man. He's always bounced around in and out, just kind of, he's a clown, man. He's hilarious. So, I think I owe him some royalties for some of those moves I took from him.
I take it these are BMX moves or?
No, man. Oh. He's just being, he's just clowning around. Like, okay. Yeah, he doesn't ride a bike or anything, man. He's a TV industry guy.
I got you.
He's the dude that like behind the scenes pulls all the strings to make sure that you get to do what you do. And dude, what's funny is, some days I'm out on the Indy 4130 ride on Sundays riding with the guys, and I'll get a call from him and say, hey man, so-and-so didn't show up. Do you want to work the Colts game? And it's already like call time was like 8 a.m. Okay. For a 1 p.m. game. All right. I'm riding until like noon and I'm not coming in until then. He's like, I don't care, man. As long as you're in here, you know, to run the parab on the sidelines, you know, I was like, yep, I'll see you a little afternoon then. And I get paid for a 10-hour day, dude. And I would only work like 5 or 6 on those days, but I was there to help him out and I know what I'm doing. So it's easy and I'm peace of mind. So that's what, you know, and I got that call quite a bit because sometimes people just, you know, there's a lot of people that travel in this industry. And so sometimes, you know, the logistics, you missed a flight. The flight was late. It was delayed. You didn't get there, whatever.
Need somebody to cover. Call Bill.
So he's the dude that always calls me up for those kind of gigs. Like when I work those Colts games or college and whatever, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Makes sense. Well, shout out to Danny.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. He's supplemental income. It's not much, but it's fun. Hey, dude, when you got like pro NFL players and you're a pro athlete yourself and you're on the sidelines, and these dudes are running right at you and you're pointing a microphone dish at the sound and you do a sidestep as they just get pummeled out of bounds. Like,
right.
Love it, man. I try to get in their line just so I can make those moves and make the TV shots sometimes. Yeah. Look at the move that guy made. I don't know if you ever saw that guy doing the parab, Mike, when the runners come out of the tunnel and he ran right across in front of it when they were coming out and he just got leveled.
I did see
like
that.
Like by a 400-pound lineman. Bam, he went flying, man.
Don't do that.
No, don't do that. You got to watch these guys, man.
Okay, note to self. I ever get
I've almost gotten kicked in the head by the so the kickers are on the sidelines kicking into those nets, and I'm set up right next to them, and all I hear is boom, boom, boom. And I got headphones on with a giant microphone, like, blasting in my ears, and I can still hear these dudes kicking the balls. So I'm that close, and I'm like, I got people holding me, making sure I don't back up into them, you know, and take a foot up the butt or something. I would hate to get by one of those kickers, man.
Yeah. Now I got to look for you on Colts Sundays, see if I see you on the sidelines.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, Anthony played for the Toronto Argonauts. You may have heard of them. Professional CFL. Yeah.
Farm team, not the actual CFL.
All right.
Are you still getting letters from them, like scouts, to come play some more?
No, I'm too fucking old.
My stepdad was like a superstar in high school, and he kept getting he went into the military right after high school. But, dude, I remember even in my teenage years, we would get letters from NFL teams in the mail all the time from scouts trying to get him to go try out or whatever.
Yeah, no, I wasn't that level.
Dude, well, Anthony was too busy, right? He was too busy riding BMX all through high school. Didn't even play football. And then he decided to try out after high school.
This guy's decent size. He rides a BMX bike. He has no brains. Get him.
Yep. Yeah, he's tough.
Make a good lineman. Yeah.
Look, all you need to do is smash that guy with the ball every time.
I played O-line. I was opening up holes for guys with the ball.
All right. Crush the guys so the ball can get through.
Yeah.
Oh, you're – guard, we're going to pull the guard and smash the guy on the end, man. That guy half your size.
Yeah. Yep.
That's good stuff.
There's some strategy in there, I'm sure.
Oh, man. Offensive line, dude, that's the side that's got the brains. The defense just crushes the ball carrier.
That's right.
Yeah, you got to be smart and big on the offensive side.
All right, moving on. I got a lot of questions here.
Get you going.
Corey Kearns out of Windsor, Ontario. Shout out to Corey.
Canadians.
Yeah. Used to ride with Chase and Brandon and all those guys. Anyways, he's like, my question is, how and where do you find the energy to keep up with your riding, perform shows, and recover from whatever surgery you may have to undergo? The positive energy is awesome. It's great to still have such a positive role model for our sport. So I guess he's asking about where you keep the energy and then giving you a bunch of compliments. Thanks, hey, Corey.
Thanks, Corey. I appreciate it, dude. Thanks for the compliment. I'm the Energizer Bunny. That's me in the ads in an outfit. Ching, 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 ching. Still going. Honestly, man, if you want to put a medical term on it, I was blessed with something called ADD, ADHD, whatever you want to call it. I have an endless supply, that type of that ADD or whatever. I have an endless supply of energy. Obviously, doing what you love to do every day isn't a bummer. So even though you can kind of get the winter depressions, you still have the motivation of getting to go out and do what you love to do. So that energy is based on a lot of it coming from that I still am really happy about what I do. And the hardest part, honestly, is keeping that motivation when you're coming out of energies. Like you had mentioned, you know, how do you do it when you got energies, you know, and coming back from that? That's the challenging part of it. You wonder every major injury that you have when you go under the knife, how well you're going to be after you come out of that. Are you going to be just as good? Are you going to be better? Are you going to suck? Are you ever going to be able to ride again? You know, and I'm still in that stage right now with my hips, even though I haven't missed a show from any surgeries during all this. You still have that feeling of, do I have 100% still in me? And I know I do. And I just have to tell myself it's a matter of time. So I just take it easy, grow right back into it and keep going. But for some weird reason, man, the energy level's still there. I have my brother ask me, he goes, hey, man, how do you have – he asked me the same question. How do you have that energy? And I just keep going. He goes – and this is – dude, this is probably 20 years ago he asked me this, you know, because he's older than I am, is my stepbrother. And he goes, man – he goes, my energy level, it ran out at 40. And I was like, what? And I was like, that sucks, you know. And so every year I keep going, and, like, people keep asking me that question. I always think back to him when he said his ran out at 40, and I was like – I know a lot of people's do, but I'm wondering when that day is going to happen for me. I'm not like looking forward to it. Not at all, man, because like when I don't move anymore, that sucks. That's a bad day. I need that energy to keep going, but I'm slow right now. I'm not at my pace that I'd like to be at, you know?
How much do you sleep at night, Bill?
About 3 hours.
You know, Kent Pearson's kind of like that too.
I'm on about a 21 hour day, sometimes longer, sometimes I won't sleep for like 36 hours, maybe 20, say 2 days.
I figured you're one of those type of personalities that didn't get much sleep. Just you're go, go, go.
Oh, dude. And here's what's even crazier, man. I'm surprised anybody on the team would have had you asked this question. Ask Bill how much he eats or drinks in a day. Not much.
No?
I eat like once a day, and it's like somewhere in the middle of the night. And I don't eat all day at all, man. I don't drink. Like I haven't drank alcohol or anything carbonated since like back in November, but waters, like I'll have some waters throughout the day, a little bit here and there. Maybe like one bottle of water will get me through a whole day. I just keep going, burning that energy, man. Like it's just natural. I'm lucky. I'm blessed. I tell a lot of people, especially at the shows we do, you know, they're like, oh, well, we got to keep the special, you know, kids with ADD and stuff, you know, out because they're just, I'm like, no, man, those are the kids I want. I go, you don't realize you have a blessing. Those kids have a blessing, you know. They have something that you'll never, ever have and you'll never understand. And you'll try to suppress it with like Adderall or Ritalin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like, yeah.
Don't do that to those kids because you're going to appreciate what those kids have one day. Just like that question, how does Bill have that? When you're younger, man, people want to suppress that because they don't want you running past them. Everybody wants to keep you behind them in line. They want to be ahead, you know? And it's like, dude, I just have fun with that energy and just keep going.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's a blessing.
Brandon Fenton chimed in.
Oh, yeah.
What is the most important thing that Flatland has brought to his or to your life?
Honestly, I mean, BMX in general, with everything across the board, I've raised a family riding my bike. I've raised 4 kids. And if you know how much it costs to raise a kid from 0 to 17, it's over $250,000 right now. So you just imagine how much money I've made riding my bike. I don't have anything to show for it, but 4 good looking kids. I do. I'm joking, hey, man.
And a Denali with 500,000.
Yeah. I mean, it's just honestly a blessing to have, like, to be able to raise a family riding my bike and to not have to stress doing that, you know, like, oh, I hope I make it again this year. I hope I make it again this year. You know, I don't have to worry about that. It's going to come in. You know, I've built something that's residual and it keeps coming in. You know, people want me back. It's like we're teams like us are the bands of like the 80s that get to keep going out and keep doing it, and they've been doing it their whole career,
like the
man.
Stones
killing it. Yeah.
Like, when are they gonna quit? They're so old.
Oh, dude, imagine like we're the Rolling Stones and BMX one day. I'm ahead of you. I know that, man. I'm gonna be like Bill Nitschke, Keith Richards, man. How does that guy keep going? How's he even alive doing that up on stage?
Yeah. All right. So I want to apologize to Glenn here because I'm going to mispronounce his name. I'm going to butcher it. But here, Glenn Meltreder. Yeah. How do you say it?
Meltreder.
Okay, I got it right. Yeah, good guy.
Glenn's awesome. And
he was at the jam in St. Louis we were at last weekend.
Yeah.
Shout out to Glenn. Agro he jam. Says, at the beginning of the Bully Tour in 1990, where is Water Street? And what is the story? Raleigh, North Carolina. I don't know what he's talking about.
Maybe so in 1990, Perry's ride for Bully, and they came through Indy. And I don't know if you ever got the luxury or the fortune of going to like an 80s BMX show. When it was done, you're like, hey, man, can we just jump in your van and truck or the trailer and just ride with you guys on tour? Come on, man. My parents don't mind. You know, and you always wanted to get on tour with the team, right? Well, that happened when Perry came through town. I jumped in the ride with him in the red Suburban on the Bully Tour, and we took off, man. There was room. There was a seat open, and we took off, you know. And I went on tour with those guys for a while just to go and hang out.
The Bully Tour.
And we ended up in, I think it was like North Carolina or something like that, and we went to Glenn's house. Well, at this time, you know, we're still kids. We were only like 20. And they had these squirt guns that were automatic. You put batteries in them and you fill them up and you just pull the trigger and it goes ning, 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 ning. And it's squirting water automatically, right? Just squirt guns, nothing powerful or anything like that. But they would shoot like maybe, I don't know, 35, 40 feet. They weren't like pressure washers, but they would just shoot streams of water out. So anyway, we had those, and that's a college town. We picked up Glenn and all of us, and we were all out driving around the college. And we'd roll down the windows and we'd ask people something like, you know where Water Street is? And they'd be like, no. And we go, ding, 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 and squirt them with the squirt guns. And then we'd take off. And we got so many college kids pissed at us that were chasing us down and everything else, man. We're like, go, go, go. We got to get out of here. You know, because like these are like, I don't know, we're just scrawny little BMXers in a truck, you know, driving around town. It was like the red Suburban they had in Rat or something, you know. We were just like we were just having fun, but that was what that's from. So that was a pretty good time.
Classic. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Glenn. Thanks, Glenn. So Zachary Newman chimed in. And his question is, how does he feel his position geographically has helped or hurt his BMX career? And other than the standard deal, has there ever been an almost move?
An almost move? I gotcha. All right. The first question again was what?
How do you feel your position geographically has either helped or hurt your BMX career?
I'm going to start with that because I'm going to forget that second part.
Right.
Geographically, I dominate the Midwest. I love the Midwest. If I was not a mechanic, you know what it's like out here, dude. People aren't going to drive what I'm going to drive to get to these shows. I'm going to do like last Friday, I spent 12 hours in my truck for one show in Chicago. All right.
Yeah.
What's somebody going to pay you to spend 12 hours in your truck driving around? Tell me how much you're going to enjoy a day and a half's worth of work sitting in your truck, right?
Right.
Just to go out and do 40 minutes worth of entertainment. So that's what I'm like.
Do it all the time. Yeah.
Geographically, I love it, man. I've got the Midwest locked down. And if you came in here and did a show, I wouldn't even know and I wouldn't even care. I don't care about that. There's so much, and I've told everybody this, there's so much out here. But again, nobody does it consistently like I do in travel because they just couldn't afford to do that. You know, they don't know how to do it. Having to pay for all the dude, if I had to pay for service on my trucks, I couldn't do it. There's no way I could do that. The parts are expensive. And then to put them on, you know, even labor's. Yeah. So you're going to pay twice, whatever, you know, times two, what your parts cost is what you're going to pay. So
yeah, I don't understand these guys that don't work on their vehicles. I don't know how they do.
Yeah. No matter who books, even with you, you're going to start to realize that if you book for me, it's easy. You know, you might not make a lot now, but you're going to make a lot over years because a lot of the shows that we do are residual income. They're calling and booking over again and over again. And it's like, it doesn't matter who books for us. If it's us or anybody else, it just keeps coming in. So the Midwest is on lockdown. I don't have to go and travel like I used to go all over and thought like, oh man, if I do shows down here, over here, way out here, that's cool, man. That's the best. Nah, that sucks. That's a lot of extras, man, that you don't really need to make money, you know? And at this point, it's like, I'm not trying to be the best in the world, you know? I'm trying to be the best at having fun, at doing what I do for a living, my love and my career, man. That's what I'm trying to do, you know? And if I impress somebody or inspire somebody, that's cool, man, bonus, you know? But the Midwest is great for me. I love it. Honestly, it's kind of seasonal, really, when it comes down to it. So in the wintertime, especially now, that gives me the 3 or 4 or 5 months I need off to get surgeries done and, you know, get back to healthy.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's nice to get that free time.
Now, sure. Yeah. As far as an almost move,
yeah.
No, I've never. The only reason that I went out to Cali was for the winter time, you know, and that's only a temporary thing. Was just a ride, and then when I moved to Iowa and lived at Rampage again, that was a winter thing to ride indoors, and that was it. And I ended up, I was only going to stay there for the winter. I was only going to be there for like 3 or 4 months and back home to Indy for the summer. You know, the rest of the year and then keep doing what I do. But I end up staying. When I moved back from Iowa, dude, I had no plans to ever move anywhere else ever again.
Yeah. Okay. Indianapolis, there you go, dude. Zach.
Indiana is great. I love this state.
Chris Pizzawara comes in with a question. Chris is one of my main show riders right now. Awesome dude out of New Jersey.
Yeah. And
yeah, he says, no question. Just a thank you for creating one of the raddest tricks ever. Appreciate you, Mr. Bill. And I'm pretty sure he's referring to the Whopper.
Dude, thank you. I appreciate it, man. I'm glad you get to enjoy it. I had no idea, again, like I said earlier, I had no idea what it was going to turn into and how it was going to kind of become a mainstream staple trick of BMX. I mean, like a tabletop, dude. Everybody does a Whopper. Like even if you're on a ledge going into a bank, you know, you're still doing a Whopper. You can't call it a whip. It's a Whopper. You're bunny hopping. So I'm stoked. Thank you. You know, that's awesome. I'm glad you get to enjoy it.
Yeah, hell yeah. Well, shout out, Chris. Awesome. So I got questions all over the place, like fucking Instagram, and Facebook. And so Brandon Fenton has another one here. He says, is there anything in the world that would get you to make pegs again?
Yeah. If everybody else's pegs stuck,
That's a good
Everybody else has bit my designs that are even still out there to this day, except for the IGI pegs. And I was the first one to kind of round those pegs on the ends also. If you look at the Groots pegs right now, there's a style that I did like that back in 93 or 4. And that's why I'm running his pegs today. I'm running Deco.
You got the Deco pegs?
Yeah, I love them because they're similar to what I made. The diameter is just a little bit smaller than what I made back then. But it's identical. A little bit longer, but identical to what I made. And I love them. So I'm running his pegs. You know, obviously it's styled after mine, but maybe there's a chance. I thought about it, you know, with our e-commerce site, putting a bunch of stuff online and not necessarily like, you know, putting it out there for us, but putting it out there for other people. So there's a chance. If I do, I'll tell you what I don't like about manufacturing real quick in a nutshell, the turnaround on profit time. That's it in a nutshell. It takes so much to make a little.
Yeah.
Props to all the teams, all the companies that are still manufacturing great products to this day. It is not easy. Keep going, guys. Don't quit, man. if I didn't ride and love to ride my bike and do what I do and show off, I would still definitely have a bike company and be bigger than anything on this planet by now. Because you know all how right. I do it. I don't have
fair enough.
I don't half step it.
No, you don't. Neela came in. Do you know Neela from Toronto? She used to go to all the Toronto jams. She's an Indian lady.
Not by name, but I, you know how it is. You meet a lot of people, and it's like, I don't get their names all the time. Like, hey, I'm riding, man. And you know me, I don't stop riding, so I don't have time to have a lot of conversations.
Well, shout out to you, Neela. She just asked, ask him if he's happy.
I'll be happier when I'm 100%, but am I happy right now? Yeah. I mean, think about it. So many great things are happening right now. My fourth and youngest is graduating this year. This year is also my 40th year, 4 decades, by the way. Why don't you ask me a question about quadruple decades? So 4 decades of doing shows, right?
Right. I mean,
dude, come on. Shows are coming in like in the handfuls on the daily right now. So this year is looking really, really good. Yeah, I'm really happy. I could always be happier, but man, you'd have to do something amazing to make me happier. I'm affected by money because it makes this world go round, but I don't live for money. You know what I mean? So cool things, cool feelings, cool places, cool people. That makes me happier than anything, man. You know what I mean? When everything's flowing effortlessly, that makes me happy. And that's kind of what things are doing right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Good answer. Chad Brixley. I think I said that right. B-R-I-X-E-Y. Chad Brixley. All right. Is the geometry of your titanium bike, you're riding a titanium frame right now, is the geometry of your tie bike much different than brackets or based off of something stock? And how much different does the weight and material make your riding?
Okay, in a nutshell, the two bikes that I rode before, I built that layered titanium double top tube, first in the world frame. I rode the Yole Master and I rode a 2010 Sabrosa Pandora double top tube, the 19 inch top tube.
All right. Those must have been quite different.
Very, very. But when you blend the two and you bring them together and you put it to what you like, and there's like decades had a lot to do with certain geometry on this bike. But this is all my geometry on there. So it's a custom geometry based on what I liked out of those two bikes for the type of tricks that I do. So yeah. And there's 3.7s in there, by the way, man. If you're, you know, the Holy Roller, that's kind of the secret name of that bike. You know, 777?
I don't, but everybody does. Guy, but
that's all right. 777, man. Those are heavenly numbers, you know?
Oh, on the side that's why I don't know.
On the side of Jesus, on the side of good, you know? I know you've heard of the triple sixes. Yeah, I tried to keep those out of
so the sevens. There you go. Okay.
There you go. Anyway, that's what the sevens represent in there, and that's what it came from. Now
I know more about Satan, apparently.
Now, that's all right, man. Everybody finds out when they start to realize that death's around and knocking at your door.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's when you find God.
Here and find out if this is real. I see it happen on the daily, man, but that's all right. You know, that's what it's all about. Always finding a good place to go. So check this out, though. The weight.
Okay.
3 pounds is the difference between my Haro Master that I rode, that Yole Master, and that layered frame. The difference is about another $6,000 for 3 pounds. Does it make a difference? Did you see me do that Jerry Smith decade at the Crown Point show and how long my hand was off and how I balanced up there?
Yeah,
that 3 pounds was worth that extra $6,000, that one trick.
Yeah. So is the frame alone 6,000?
No. My Haro costs about 5,000. The last two bikes that I built before that cost me about $5,000 to build those bikes. This one's up around 11.
Oh, it's, okay.
Dude, it's mostly titanium.
Yeah.
Yep. Every nut and bolt.
Can we ask what the geometry is, like roughly sure. on the frame?
You can ask.
You don't want to share that with us?
Well, it's real simple, man. Keep up, guys. Here we go. 75 head tube, 19 top tube, standover. What was it? Seat tube is 71 and a half. The seat height was 7.5, I think I did on that one. The rear end is 12 and a half.
Oh, wow. Real tiny.
Yeah. So there's my numbers.
Okay. Yep. So you kind of, that sounds kind of like the Yole geometry a lot.
Well, that's what I'm saying, man. So Yole's top tube was 6'1", and the Sabrosa was 8'5".
Right.
And I went right in between there, like the sweet spot, right in between there was 7'5". So I went with 7.5 on that. And then the seat angle between those two, one was 71, one was 72. I went 71.5.
The rear end on the Sabrosa must have been longer.
The rear end on the Sabrosa was about 13 and a half. So I shortened that by an inch, and that made a big difference. But still same 19 top tube.
Right. Yeah. Pretty standard.
Great geometry, man. I love it.
Cool. That's a pretty amazing bike you got.
Awesome. I joked around with like when I was riding with Glenn and all those guys, the Cincinnati Flatland Fanatics, Glenn Meltrader, because we'd ride over at their place in the winter and then up at the Crown Point thing. I was like, dude, I kept saying when I was riding and pulling some stuff out of my butt, I was like, don't look at me, man. It's not me. It's the bike. It's not me. It's the bike. I'm not kidding you, man. It really is. And what's funny is 3 pounds feels like a huge, like my street park bike, my Intricate that I ride park on is 23 pounds. But that 3 pounds, that bike feels like a tank.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, I put Ty cranks on my bike and it made a huge difference.
Yeah.
Huge difference. So I can only imagine what a frame would be like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Agro Designs chimed in here and he just put on a great jam in St. Louis, by the way. He's like,
I wish I could have made that.
Why ain't you in the Hall of Fame, bro?
I don't know.
I don't either.
That's the answer. I think good things come to those who wait. Honestly, man. I mean, if it does happen, it'll be cool to be surprised, you know, instead of like just expecting it or something. You know what I mean?
I think
it'd be cool, you know, to be remembered in there. I'd be stoked.
Yeah. I feel like
it's not like I'm doing anything else in life, you know?
You're BMX all the way. I'll give you that.
Do you know that one stipulation was, I joked around about this because obviously I was nominated for the Hall of Fame back in 2021. But there in the bylaws in there, you have to be retired from competition for 5 years. And the time I got in, I was still competing.
I joked around about that.
I was like,
you have to retire.
I'm still actively competing. And then
the next question is,
how old are you again? That's why I'm not in, by the way, man. It's because I'm actively competitive. Let's just put it that way.
That's your answer. There you go, Agro.
Waiting. I mean, imagine what's going to happen when I get on that stage. I'm going to light that stage up like no other Hall of Famers lit it up. I can't
know shit. Yeah.
Let me know when that happens. I need to be there.
Oh, dude, I'm renting tour buses for that party. You just get the Indy man and get on the bus.
All right. Glenn Vanderhayden up there in Canada. This question is sponsored by Duke's Mayonnaise. I'm just going to say that. This man loves him some mayonnaise. I don't even know if they sell Dukes up there.
They do not.
You know what? You already answered this question. Whip hop, whopper,
Yeah.
He did it first, but did he name it? And we all know that you did. Okay. Yeah. So moving on, Roy de Guzman, Smiley. Boy, all he has to say is, So I'm going to ask, where does Ja come from?
Okay, so back in the 80s, Steve Mulder had a bunch of like basement rap tapes, the stuff that was not mainstream that you'd find at like a record shop, right? Like a
Karma. Oh, before you answer this, actually, the same question comes from Dave Holden of, I don't know what his company's called now.
Now it's No Holding Back.
No Holding Back BMX show. Okay, same question. Yeah, where does Ja come from?
All right, so back in the day, obviously me and Stephen Perry riding together every day on the daily, and Steve would bring these basement rap tapes, man, like rappers that you never heard of, never made it, and he had them on these cassette tapes. And so he'd bring those, you know, and I don't know if he caught it somewhere while he was listening to this or something like that, because if you listen to some of the reggae back in the day, they always say Ja, but that's J-A-H. So he kind of turned that into Ja, and we all kind of turned that into Ja as meaning like if you hit a really cool trick, you know, instead of saying yeah, we would say Ja. And then it got even crazier. Like when you did something really cool, you'd have a jagasm. Now these dudes didn't have jagasms like I had. I had jagasms for like
a jagasm.
I would be riding. Like if somebody did something cool and I had a jagasm, I'd be riding around. And I'd be like, slam on both brakes, jump up and over the bars, and throw my hands into the Ja hand and kind of be like spazzing out of control, like a fish out of water, and going Ja. Up in the air. I wish you could see what I did because we don't have video capability for me right here, but I wish you could see what I did. So anyway, you would have
a Ja jaw face.
So yeah, I'd be like, Ja, and I'd throw both Ja hands up in the air and throw them around and be like, Ja. So you're jumping over the handlebars, okay? It's not like you're just jumping away from your bike. You're jumping over the handlebars. So, you know, obviously you've done that and probably tripped doing that before, I'm sure, goofing around. But anyway,
accident. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of where that came from, was back in that like latter part of the 80s, around like 87, I think 88. So we had Steve Mulder created the Two Ja Crew, and that's who we were, was the Two Ja Crew. Then there was Two Ja Crew, and if you were kind of like a dweeb or whatever, a follower of the Two Ja Crew, you were in Stiff's posse. Steve's nickname was Stiff. So the Two Ja Crew and Stiff's posse. Do we have cards? I still have cards, the Two Ja Crew cards. From this time. So that's where Ja came from. So Ja was just that overwhelming excitement of Ja. So if I see you doing something cool, man, I'm going to yell Ja. So a lot of times if there's a video, I'll post two things on videos. If I see you do something really cool, like you got a lot of stuff that's really cool lately on video, man. I'm enjoying your riding, like I told you the other day. And so if you ever see me put sick, S-I-C, or Ja, yeah, obviously we know what Ja means now. But sick also for something that I created. Six stands for, because you're doing something super cool, man. You're dominating it. Sucka in charge. Sick. That's what that stands for. So if you ever see me put sick, it's not just meaning the meaning of like sick. That was cool. You know, it means sucka in charge. It means you got my attention, buddy. So thank you for that. Oh, and that's where Ja comes from. But sick is something that I kind of came up with, and Ja stuck, you know. So every time you see me throw the three fingers up with the thumb, the index finger, and the middle finger, that's the Ja hand. You know, I'm not
jazz hands, but Ja hand. All right,
you know, yeah.
So this is uniquely you, Steve, and Perry.
Yes, this is straight out of Indy for real.
I love
And actually, like, we lived in Greenwood, you know, which is a suburb of Indy on the south side of it. Now, obviously, I grew up in Indianapolis, but then was raised for a while in Greenwood. So we called ourselves the Greenwood Hood. So, yeah. But we were all, like, the core right here in Indy.
Dave also asked a question, and I thought it was kind of a dumb question. But then I was like, you know what? It's actually a pretty smart question.
Never a dumb question. So
can I ask you? Well, no such thing as a dumb question. But he's like, why H to the B instead of just a simple happy birthday? Because I say different. I say H to the B too. It just sounds
It's
cool,
different.
Right?
It's just different, man. I mean, it's just, I started doing it a long time ago and I just did it. It was different than happy birthday, man. I got like happy birthday.
How many happy birthdays can you get?
I appreciate it. We all appreciate it, but it's happy birthday, man. It's been said for years. H to the B.
Dare to be different.
Yeah. Like you could wrap it out, you know, or something like that. I don't know. It's different. That's it. That's all.
I like it. Good answer. Todd Miller. What's up, Todd? I think he's told the story before, but ask him about the name Whopper and how it came about.
Yeah,
we already answered that. Also, how do we get street riders to call the trick by its proper name? Ha ha.
You don't. You really, really don't, man. I mean, that's the short answer, guys. You just don't. Like, here's what's cool, though. Okay, and this is what we talked about earlier, and I mentioned that I didn't realize how mainstream and staple of a trick it was going to become. I really didn't, man. We just did tricks because it was harder and different than anybody else. We wanted to be original. That's why we did it. But here's the crazy part was that, like, I forgot where I was going with that one right there. I knew that was going to happen sooner or later. What was the question again?
Well, he's like, how do we get street riders to call?
Oh, yeah. The name of it. Okay. So when a trick becomes normal, right? And it's just becomes, it just so common to kids that don't even know the background of it. And they just call it a nickname.
Hop whip. That's all they're going to call it. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, man. Your trick is cool when it gets a nickname. I used to not like it because I was like, yo, man, give me respect. I earned it. You know, like I went to college. I became a doctor. Call me doctor. I earned it, you know? And right. Kind of like I made up and invented a trick. Call it by its name. And I used to get a little upset when it was early on, when there were just a few people doing it. And then when it started, right when I first called, I heard it called a hop whip. I was like, man, I go, come on, dude. So once in a while, you'll see I'll reply like to people in their posts when they call it that. I'll type in like, nice whopper. Yeah, I learned to whopper back when I was, you know, in this year or something. And I'll just kind of, it's a simple correction for them. Like, you know, so they might not know what it's called. They might have just grown up. Think about a wheelie for a second.
No, they don't know. They don't know.
What's another name for a wheelie?
Manual.
Yeah, okay, a manual or a catwalk. A catwalk was one. If you were in the hood, you didn't do a wheelie. You did a catwalk. Yo, catwalk that sucker. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know,
walk it.
Catwalk. And it had a goofy nickname to it. Dude, does the guy that invented the wheelie, did he get pissed because they nicknamed his trick? Nah, man, eventually it's kind of cool that your trick got a nickname. And what's funny is that, like, they didn't make it shorter. They made it more complicated. They made it two words instead of one. I tried to help them. It's Whopper. Nah, man, we're going to call it Hop Whip. Okay.
All right.
So I guess it's cool, man. You know, that's the way I look at it. It's cool if it gets a nickname. It's so famous. Got a nickname.
I mean, it's a staple now. Bar spins and tail whips are like almost like, you know, if you're going to be doing shows, they're like, you got to do those, you know?
Dude, I get stoked. I'll tell you what, the ASA, I did some shows for them a while back when they were in town and Micah Kranz was announcing. And
He's a great announcer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hadn't done a Whopper in a while, right? And I'm in the show. We're like in Martinsville, Indiana. And Micah calls me out and I was like, Oh God, I haven't done one in a while, man. All right. But give it everything you got, man. I mean, I used to rip the heads off the shafts of stems learning this from bunny hopping so hard. Right. I was trying to pull my bars out of this stem, dude. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago now.
So he knows you're like 50 at the time, right?
Oh, that's why, dude, there's video of it, but he actually said he went into the whole thing like you do about this guy created it, but this is the guy that invented it. This trick's called this. Ladies and gentlemen, I went, and this guy kind of put it. He was like, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand that this is like watching, when you watch the creator of their art or whatever, this is like watching Babe Ruth hit a home run right now. And that's what he kind of said was, he acted like Babe Ruth, but this is like watching Babe Ruth hit a home run live. And I threw the first one and almost hit it. I kind of slipped my pedal on the ride out and I threw the second one and stomped it, dude. Absolutely stomped it. I mean,
what was the last one you had pulled?
Probably at an AFA contest. Not it was like, I mean, it wasn't like years, but it was like at an AFA contest.
Like original AFA?
Yeah, when I was back in the pro class. Yeah. Like probably in 19, I think, maybe.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And you pulled it.
Yeah. And it was a fast moving one in a pavilion. Oh, dude, you should see it when I do like high speed whoppers. That trick's scary, but fun. Like I did that one at the AFA contest, the Battle in the Rockies, right at the judges table, right when he was over for that one. I nailed it, landed, and was rolling right at him and looked right at him as I was like landing it. He's like, he said that was still one of the coolest things he'd ever seen. I was like, that's cool, man. I'm glad you got to witness it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as you get older, it's probably going to be less and less of that trick, I would think.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I love speed and edge, you know, like when I'm riding. I like to be on that line still. I'm curious to see. I've already fallen on the new hip, the first hip that I had, my left one. I fell on that 3 times in a show 29 days after I had it put in.
How'd that feel?
The first 2 times, it wasn't bad. The third time, I did like a 180 slider, and I went to take my foot off just to kind of step out of it because the floor was sticky. Well, the signals from my brain to my feet at that time weren't really that fast, and so my foot never moved, and I went right over, and I fell right on the incision point. And I was sitting there announcing the guys, and I kind of put my hand on my hip, and I was like, why are my shorts all wet? And I looked at my hand, and it was just covered in blood. Like, oh, I'd blown the incision open from, like, you know, yeah. So I was going to get the right hip done, like, the next week anyway, so I just kind of, like, kept a big gauze pad on, like a Depends on my hip, tape to it, you know, so it would soak up the blood until I went in, and I was like, all right, man, I'm here for the next one. And by the way, can you put a couple sutures back over in this one that you just did? I fell on it. He looked at me, the surgeon was like, are you serious? I go, yep.
Yep.
So he put a couple sutures in it, man, on that side, and then changed the right side, and I was all good to go after that.
Shit.
Yeah.
All right, we got questions from 2 more people, but they both had several questions here. So we'll try to fire through it. Our good friend Graham Burke, originally from Toronto, out in SF.
Yeah,
now.
Graham.
Yeah, yeah. I actually met up with Graham a couple weeks ago.
I've done shows in Toronto a couple times.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Awesome city. Awesome city.
I actually stayed in those suites that overlook the outfield at the that dome right there next to the
– oh, wow.
Rogers
the Jays, the Toronto Blue Jays play.
Yeah.
We were doing a promotion. It was like we did a preseason tour with the Indiana Pacers that went to 3 different provinces up there.
Oh, wow.
Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and Toronto.
Oh, you've been in Newfoundland?
Hey, you ready for this one, Canadians? I did the Canadian basketball final 8 back in 1991, or I think it was like 91. Yeah. So you know how we have our college Final 4 right now, our March Madness for college basketball?
Yeah.
Your college basketball you guys have up there? I did the halftime shows for all those games, the whole weekend's worth.
No kidding. In the 90s.
Yep. And that was in we were in Nova Scotia for that one.
You went to Newfoundland. You went to Newfoundland.
Yeah. I think Labatt's was the sponsor for that, man. We went to this suite. They had a suite party for all these execs we went to. We were invited, and we walked into this suite at this hotel, and every wall from the time you entered the door, about 4 feet tall, was cases of beer. Like, if you put wainscoting around your room, it was stacks of cases of beer, 4 foot tall, all the way around the room as a perimeter.
Sounds like my apartment with Jamie McGovern, eh?
Yeah. Those empties.
Molson Export.
Oh, they were empty.
Oh, yeah, they were definitely empty. But we would make money when we went to the beer store and returned our bottles.
Would you, though? Yeah.
All right, go for Toronto. Did we answer the question, or we just get on Toronto kick?
Oh, yeah. All right, we're going to get to these questions here. All right. Questions for Bill, if there is time. We got time, right, Anthony?
We got time. I'm not going anywhere.
Go for it.
All right. Number 1, what got you into machining and how old were you?
19, and it was just a necessity again of having to build stuff that wasn't done yet and that we couldn't get our hands on. So I wanted to keep riding and keep pushing it, and the product wasn't holding up. So that's why. Necessity.
Did you machine all your products or
No, I had everything done. I didn't have time for that, man. I was too busy riding all day.
What products did you make that never went to market, like one-offs or prototypes?
Nothing. I made everything I ever wanted to make up until I left Standard, and then I did Indie Industries and made everything I wanted to make there. Yeah.
All right. Well, final question. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. For young folks that want to learn machining today, do you know what options they have given many schools no longer have machine shops? Oh, so he's asking for young folks today that
I understand. So when I was in high school, one of the things I did to get out of school earlier every day, because anything that I could, any extra minutes I could do and get back out of school, I could put onto my bike. But one of the things that I had an option to do by the time I was in my junior year was a place called Central 9, which was type of vocational school for students that could go learn different trades. Like I went over there for business. I didn't learn anything but to run a 7-Eleven, you know, that was about all I learned. It was 101, but they actually had, you know, like body shop and machine shop and things like that. So some schools do still have trade options like that where you're in high school and you can go and do that. So if you're younger, see if your school has a trade school that you can go to. And what's cool about that is that it's not one school that goes to one trade school. It's a bunch in your community that come together. So you get to hang out and meet a bunch of other kids from other schools in your surrounding district and hang out with them, you know, for half the day. So I would go to regular school half the day, go to like 3 or 4 hours of class, eat lunch, hop on a bus or drive over there for the other half of the day. And what was cool was I said I was trying to get out earlier is that when you're over there and they had to bus you back, well, that was extra time that you had that you got out. And if you drove, you got that bus time going back to the school where you could just leave C9
and straight to the parking lot.
Yep, exactly. So I did that.
Yeah, I did the same thing for auto mechanics.
The other thing is, you know, ask around, man. See if you can get your foot in the door somewhere. Start out at anything, you know. Go to a machine shop and say, hey, what do you have? I want to learn. A lot of times these people put you on doing simple things like just cutting metal. You know, you see all that, those bars over there, you know, that 50,000 pounds of bars, cut all those to 2 inches long each, you know, and those bars are 20 some feet long. You know, and they just start out doing stuff like that. So get your foot in the door. Don't, you know, nobody's going to jump on and be a machinist. Dude, I don't even do that. I'd have no clue what I'd be doing now. All the digital stuff is way ahead of the analog stuff that did when I.
Yeah. I think Graham was inspired by you because he made his own stems and pegs. And I hate that I forget the name of his pegs. Do you remember, Anthony? Graham Burke's products?
No.
I still got a set of his pegs. But
nice.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of guys. The Bushwhack twins, the Wright brothers in Canada, those guys are all machinists.
Right on.
Jeff DeRoche is a machinist. There's a lot of Flatlanders that make stuff, you know?
Yeah. There's quite a few dudes that, you know.
Aaron like Frost, obviously.
Dude, Dave Harrison, you know? I mean, he's...
Right?
Yeah.
Dave. I met this guy, Mark, at the jam the other day, and he's making these pegs that are made out of, like, a plastic, but it's like a carbon composite, I don't know. And he had these, like, ends that aren't aluminum, but they're not steel either. They're like some super hard metal. He had all kinds of parts on his bike. Amazing stuff. So it's pretty cool. Anyway,
using that artistic mind, man.
Yeah, man. Creative minds, you know,
the fullest
necessities. You can make stuff.
Oh yeah.
So Graham also said, thanks for making Unbreaks. I can still remember receiving it today. It made myself and my son tour coaster very happy.
Heck yeah. Dude, I still have receipts from back in the day from stuff that I sold to some people here and there, you know, or like I got like the handwritten ones where I actually like did everything, you know, like packages, shipped it and everything like that. Did CODs back in the day, you know, just hundreds of axles to them at a time, you know, like here's 400 of these, 400 of these, 400 of these. And it's like, wow, man. But just going back, you know, when people ordered stuff for me, I always got a kick out of like getting letters from everybody. I still have a bunch of those, you know, especially like people that wrote to me from overseas that didn't get that stuff, didn't have availability, you know, for it.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool. Different time.
So, yeah, I get a kick out of that, man. So I'm glad that it worked out for you. Like I said, I didn't invent it, man. I just got it in your hands a lot easier, you know?
All right, so Rodney Williams wrote a book once again, but there's a lot of good stuff in here. Rodney knows what's up, so I'm going to read off what he has to say here, if that's cool.
Yeah, go
for it. You know, finish up this podcast here. We're going to close it out with Rodney, and well, we got one more question after that. So, number one, Bill, I love watching your contest runs, especially some in 2016. At the American Flatland Association events. I've noticed you're all over the place during these runs. A Christmas tree cade here, a backwards facing wheelie to skid there, a whopper, brackets your creation, here, a no-handed cyborg, whip to locomotive there, yeah, a look back 540 cab here, a no-handed cross tea kettle carved there, et cetera, et cetera. I love the freestyle aspect of this. To me, like a mix of Dave Vanderspeck, Hamilton Abe, interesting shout out there, Pete Kearney, Joel Moody, and DMC, of course, with your very own original riding style. I notice you doing a lot more of this type of contest riding from 2016 and on. Influences for this? It's got a question mark. And then he says, riding to metal, question mark. Hell yeah, exclamation point. I don't know if these are questions or if he's just staying
safe. No, I know, yeah.
But embracing a more freestyle way of riding a flatland contest. Your roots of being a ripper of all disciplines of BMX. Having more fun, spur of the moment before contest run. Number two. So I guess that was a question, but we'll just leave it at that. Number two, your wild elephant glide lay down. York smoothie roll to unwrap the bar behind your back. Butter slip, yank to PK move you slammed this down after creating it. Then doing it to the end, your first line in your final run, riding at Jeff Phillips Skate Park.
Oh, yeah.
Woo, that's a lot. That's hard to read all that, Rodney. Yeah. But anyway, I think we most of us have seen that clip. We need to share that clip of Bill's, I mean, was it an anal intruder?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it was, right?
Okay. Oh, dude, a lot of that run was original, man. I mean, most of the tricks in there were original. I mean, I'm not calling locomotive. That's Kevin Jones. But like the way you got into it, that combo. Yep. That whip is what it was. It's that whip where your leg goes under and gets tweaked and then you snap off of it.
Yeah. Well, Rodney appreciates it. I appreciate it.
Shout out to Rodney, man.
Yeah. And then he's got more here. There's more.
I believe. Hey, I'll answer it real quick. The metal, all that stuff, riding fast on the edge, everything, man. Stu Thompson was an idol of mine when I was a kid. He rides fast. Evel Knievel showing off. And Burt Reynolds is a stuntman, you know, showing off. That's right there. There you go. You know, speed, stunts, and showing off. That's it right there in a nutshell. So I appreciate that, man, everything. But that contest at Jeff Phillips Skate Park, dude, I was on at that time. I was on
Burt
that.
So Reynolds quote. How about Sally Fields? Man, she was cute.
Yeah, frog. Dude, by the way, I want you to understand something, man. That Jeff Phillips Skate Park, and you're a show rider, so you're going to understand what I'm talking about. When you do a show inside, that floor was an ice rink, okay? It was so dusty in there and so slippery, and you'll kind of see it when I'm riding how I slide out on some of those tricks if that clip comes up. But it was a tight space, especially for my style. I need a parking lot, dude. This was like the first kind of jam circle format style like that, you know?
Right. Yeah, we'll share that so everybody can watch and see how you're slipping out.
Yeah, that was pretty fun.
You pulled that stuff, and that stalled Smith Decade at the end. Was it one-handed? I don't know. You were just up there.
One-handed Jerry Smith. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable. Oh, yeah. That was amazing.
I'm on a backwards 540 look back.
Yeah, oh, right, right. That was awesome, too.
I forgot all about that one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Rodney didn't.
Nope, he didn't. He saw it. Rodney wrote out that what you're reading is runs and things I've done.
Yeah. And he has a photographic memory. Like, he'll do this to me. He's like, oh, yeah, I saw you do this combo like 15 years ago.
He breaks it down.
Well, here he's going to do this. Matt Hoffman BS contest, 1991, Texas. Dallas, question mark. I guess he thinks it's Dallas. How long did it take for you to wire that move for a contest? And being that it's a blind bar unwrap PK variation, how many burly kidney checks from the bars did you take to wire it?
I quit counting.
Yeah. And then number three. What is your favorite trick variation and line that you've created and why? And do you still fire it out during your daily riding session?
Oh, honestly, man. I mean, I'm going to be 100% honest with you. Like a lot of the tricks that I did invent are really hard tricks. You don't see me doing roll aids to the pedals anymore. There's just certain things I just so hard to do that I don't do anymore. Even stuff that you invent, you know, eventually it's hard for you to do, you know? So. I don't know. I mean,
not unless somebody calls you out. Not unless Mike Kranz is on the mic.
Oh, man. You know, there's a G string that I do. It's like a G turn, and then you cross foot over, and the back end whips around, you go backwards. That's what I did when I did that one handed Jerry Smith Decade, except I was doing a backwards switch footed hang five instead of the G turn into it. But I like doing that. That's usually the last trick in my first run in the shows. So that's a fun trick that I still love to do because there's just so much going on that you're spinning, you're flowing, you know, you're going front wheel, you're going back wheel. So it incorporates kind of everything, you know, it incorporates stalling. like a decade. It incorporates rolling. You're switch footed. You're going one way, you're going the other. And so, yeah, front wheel and back wheel all on that one. I don't know. That one's still fun to do, but who knows? Awesome. Just ride, just big wheelies are fun even, man. You know, just doing simple stuff.
Do you still do cross footed whiplashes?
No. 990s. 990s killed me on that one a lot.
I just want to point out, I believe it was Hoffman's head. No.
Yeah.
Head you're first. Right. Head and first. Chase has got a little section in there. And then all of a sudden, there's cross-footed whiplashes. And if you're not paying attention, maybe some props go to Chase that really should have gone to Bill Nischke because he's the one doing them. You can see the bike's a Harl, not Dyno.
That's in front of Eddie Roman's house, by the way. And I was
there. That same trip.
So Matt was in me, Matt Hoffman, Dennis McCoy, Eddie Roman, and I don't know if somebody else is there at that time, but Dennis was inside. We're getting ready to go to Mission Trails and ride dirt for that meet the street, two hit, meet the dirt or whatever, or
right.
The dirt all, you know, in 91. That's right. Dennis is inside changing over to dirt tires. And I'm like, what's he doing? And just like, he's changing tires. Like, okay. So I was like, screw this, man. It's like, I'm getting my bike out and I'm going to go out here and ride around.
So Eddie filmed you doing
the cross. That's what I was doing.
Okay. Hey, did you ever ride with Steve?
That was an head first.
Yeah. Did you ever ride with Steve Goetz?
Yeah, man. I'm pretty sure back in the day, long time ago.
Because in Ride Like a Man, there's a section where they're riding in front of the Hemel Surf Shop in San Diego, right on the beach.
I've been there. Yep.
Yeah. And you remember Henry's doing the hitchhiker through traffic and all that. Well, we just rode that spot a couple weeks ago. And there's a guy in that section is riding a red Dyno who I thought was Andrew Arora. And come to find out, Sean White's like, that's not Andrew Arora. I would know. And it come to find out it's Steve Goetz. And that guy was incredible. I had no idea who this guy was until just found him. Anyway. Shout out to that guy because he's
a great man. I love it. The guys that have been around the 80s that are, you know, still riding or even got back into it, you know?
I don't know if he rides. I think he still rides. I found his Facebook and he's got some BMX pictures on there. So,
nice.
Anyways,
keep it going. Anyways.
All right. So, Rodney, there's more. Okay. I think this is the last thing he wanted to say. Number four. All right. He wanted to bring a shout out to this guy, Vladislav Yuriev. I'm going to spell it out just for anyone that's interested. Vladislav. Vladislav. And Yuriev is Yuriev. He's a new street rider, one of my favorite BMXers today. Posted on my page twice. Your thoughts on his Pete Augustin, Craig Grosso, Vic Murphy type flavor in his riding. Like yourself, he's very original as a rider. Also, and your thoughts. And I think I shared that rider with both of you guys just prior to this podcast.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, he's got BMX soul in him, you know. He goes out there and just rides. That's the true form of what BMX is all about, you know. You just go out and whatever you want to come up with. It's cool to see riders like that. You see them every so often, you know, that have certain styles that are unique like that, you know. Tim Knoll, for example, you know, do some weird off-the-wall stuff that you just out of nowhere you don't expect. So, yeah, it's cool to see that kind of stuff. Mixing some street, mixing some flat. You know, and like he mentioned, several different riders with different styles and backgrounds, you know, right there. Obviously, Pete Augustin and Craig Grasso do not ride the same way. But, you know, they have some of that flair from both of them combined. And I think that's what's cool. Like, a lot of people probably, I don't know if other people did this, but when I was younger, I modeled my style after RL just because it gave me something to kind of go after and mimic. And it was because he was different. He did switch footed stuff, but eventually you grow into your own style. You grow out of theirs and you grow into your own. And I think that's what he might be doing, you know, if he's not already there, you know, he's taken some of this and some of that and he's put it together and you create your own thing out of it. Eventually, you know, it works or it doesn't, you know, and it just depends on how much time you're willing to put into it. But I think that's what it's all about right there. You know, so guys like that, boom, go for it, man. Keep doing it. Enjoy it.
Well said.
Show us what you're working with.
I felt like I was watching a little Ricky Montana out there or something too. You know, he's just having fun on his bike.
I mean, honestly, I don't enjoy watching myself ride or anything like that. I don't go back and dissect videos. I don't even video myself anymore unless I got some kind of a challenge or something going on where I have to and have to show it. But other than that, man, it's like I enjoy watching everybody else ride. I don't care what you're doing. I just watch people and just enjoy it, you know? So
yeah. It's fun to watch people that are having fun. You know, that's what I find.
Right.
Absolutely. It doesn't even matter.
Rodney. Keep going.
Rodney. Yeah, we got to keep it a little more brief next time. I appreciate you chiming in. Good stuff here.
We just need to give Rodney a segment on the show.
We probably do. Jim Jackson. Well, he just asked stuff we already asked about. He asked about pulse pegs. And your time on Haro and your time on Homeless. So I guess we already covered that. But thanks for chiming in, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
What else should we chat about?
Hey, man, the world is yours. I don't know. If you want to see more, you can go to BillNitschke.com. If you want to book a show, you can go to www.bmx.com or BN for Bill Nitschke, www.bmx.com. Yeah, other than that, man, I'm going to be out traveling, doing my thing still. A lot of events coming up this year.
Where are you going to next, Bill?
What's that?
Where are you headed to next?
A show in Peoria. Well, I got two shows in Peoria tomorrow, and then rest of the week, and I've got off, and then shows in Ohio and Michigan next week, and then we've got Rich Hoppy's 50th birthday party coming up the following weekend. So, and then just pick up from there. So,
well, I think that one in Michigan's for me.
Is it Dundee?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
There's two of them. We got two different shows.
Okay. Well, one of them is. Yeah.
One. Maybe. One at 9 and one at 1.
I can't keep up, man.
And then I'm going back to Fort Wayne, man, to the Fort Wayne, Slam City Skate Park in Fort Wayne, Rich Hoppy's Park. Him and Dave Butler. Cool. So I'll be there for the weekend. Like I said, we're going to celebrate Rich Hoppy's 50th birthday party this weekend or next weekend. Oh. So that's cool.
Happy birthday, Rich.
Cool. Yeah, coming up, man. I don't know. There's all kinds of stuff. Just, I mean, if you want to know where I'm going to be at, wwbmx.com. The calendar's on there. The schedule's on there. You'll see where I'm going, what's happening. Hopefully, I'll be next to you, whoever you are, sooner or later.
You going to Battleground?
Oh, come on, man. Of course. Who do you think's going to put up the best trick prize money?
This guy. Yeah. $500 last year. Baller.
I put 530 up because I was 53 last year. Gee, what would I put up this year in my 54th year and it's my 40th year doing shows? What number in BMX is a circle and a half? Let me think about this. 540. Wow. Yeah. Well,
that's awfully generous of you, man.
I might have let that one out of the bag, man. Chris doesn't even know about that yet. I'm sure he's got a pretty good idea I'm doing it, but you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be good. I'll see you again there, I'm sure. We got to hang out there last year. That contest was a lot of fun. I didn't compete because obviously my hips were worn out at that point. But
right.
You get to hang out and enjoy it.
I got to say, I absolutely love the vibe that we had at that contest. Unfortunately, Chris got food poisoning, but he hired good people, I think. It went over smoothly, and it was cool.
So many veterans there that everybody took the role of what just needed to be taken without even having to talk about it because everybody's got specifics that they're really detailed in, and it worked out perfect. I mean, he didn't even show up until like what was it? The pro class?
It was over. It was almost over. Middle of pro class.
Yeah. I mean, and he was good that night. We came out. Shout out to Robert Riley, man, for buying me some wings at that restaurant we were at, you know, and dinner that night for everybody.
I think that's what made Chris.
We were walking out of the door, and Chris was standing right there with Shanda, and he looked all right. He went in to eat, dude, and that's when it happened.
Yeah.
So that was a bummer. But, man, it's going to be a good one again this year. There's a lot of events going on, man, like the old school reunion with Woodward Old School out Woodward West, the Hall of Fame ceremony. I think this is also the last year of Corn Hucket. I'm not going to make that, I don't think. I think there's always something else going on that weekend. But I don't know about York Jam.
Yeah, I don't know about York Jam. Somebody want to take the bull by the horns and step it up.
It might have had a great run. I was there at the first one. I know that.
Were you?
Yeah.
First one. What year was that?
Was it 89? I think it was.
89. Wow.
89 or 90. 89 or 90. I forget what year. Yeah.
It was right after the AFA, according to Brett, because no more contests.
That was 90. That was 90 then, because the AFA's last year was 89.
Yeah.
So a lot going on, man.
Here's there is a lot going on this year. There's a lot going on this year. So it's going to be hard to make it to everything. But
I personally am still going to have a big party here. Like we have Bill Palooza, Bill Fest, you know. Obviously, I'm going to celebrate the 40 years here. But and then there's also maybe some collaboration with another team that might be doing Back for More in 24. And we'll see what happens. We're working on some of that. So that's
cool.
Something's going to happen. It's going to be big. I usually have it at my my house here, but I'm going to need some blacktop donors, man. I need to lay a lot of blacktop down for a big flatland pad.
Yeah.
And a ramp pad and a parking pad and every other kind of pad we could lay on. Let's see as well.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I'm stoked though for it. 24 is going to be a great year, man.
Back for More. 24. Yeah. Awesome, Bill. This is a great podcast. You're so full of stories. You're such a positive dude. Full throttle, high energy. We've been wanting to have you on the podcast for a while, so I'm glad we finally did it.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. It was a great time.
Yeah, it's been an education. I kind of feel like I could just leave this recording and go to sleep, and you just fill up the tape.
I'm sure you could. There's no such thing as a conversation with Bill that's less than 45 minutes. It doesn't exist.
Nope.
I know when he calls, I'm like, all right, do I got time for this?
Anthony, you know what's funny about that is that I you know, grew up watching Johnny Carson, and he had Dean Martin on there one night, and he's talking to him, and Dean's like, oh, yeah. I watch your show every night. When I'm going to bed, you make a great nightlight.
Man, it's not like that.
That's good stuff. No, man, it just kind of, it's funny, you know, I connect the dots. That's what I'm here to do.
All right, much love, Bill. Good talking to you. We'll see you at the next jam contest event somewhere down the road. Who knows? Maybe at a Cracker Barrel. Never know with you.
Yeah, Anthony, John, I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Banter, a BMX podcast.
Nice.
Yeah!
Perfect.
Yeah! You're listening to Banter, a BMX podcast with John Doker and Anthony Berardi.